open it and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I could drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you? Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here. Today on the big program, Kathleen Kleinman, CEO of TriPill, going to be here. The Tri-County Patriots for Independent Living going to be here talking about the governor's budget, the slash and burn, the painful cuts to folks who are just trying to get by. Again, we're going to go down this road of beating up on the least among us, stealing food out of the mouths of children, kicking old ladies in the street. I know the righties keep saying, oh, we're not doing that. What did your budget do? What are you talking about? You can go and you can say all the nice words. You can go and say, oh, we believe in a social safety net. But when it comes down, when the rubber hits the road, what did you do? What did your budget do? We're going to talk to Kathleen about what this budget's going to do to the people that she serves. In the second hour, John Schmidt, senior economist over at the Center for Economic and Policy Research, going to be here talking about his, he was called to be a witness. It looked more like an inquisition, but he was called in front of the Subcommittee on Commerce, Manufacturing, and Trade. It was one of their first, I guess the first in what they were, a series of hearings that they are calling, where are the jobs? Or where the jobs are? Again, these are the people who told us, laser-like focus on jobs, jobs, jobs. This was November of 2010. We are in 2012. And now, just now, they're holding a subcommittee hearing, asking the questions, where are the jobs? We don't know. What happened to that laser-like focus? They don't know either. Kind of lost that one. Also in the second hour, Sarah Jaffe from Alternate Labor going to be here talking about the war on workers, another example of a state going after their public sector employees. And, you know, you look at Arizona, another one of the states, is already a no-rights-at-work state. Now they want to, I guess, criminalize it, or who knows? We'll talk to Sarah about that. And in the third hour, Jim Savage, president of United Steelworkers Local 10-1, going to be here talking about the refineries in Philadelphia that the big corporate CEOs are going to shut down, kicking some. The numbers I saw going to cost some 15,000 jobs. Just mind blowing. At a time when can we afford that? No. And even the Republicans are going, hey, should we be doing this? Representative Meehan, a Republican in the area, going, hey, wait a minute. We need to save these. National security, maybe. Something that we said on this program along when they first announced it. This is a national security issue. Energy is a national security issue. And we've been talking about that the last couple of days. The reality is we don't really have an energy policy. We believe in this invisible guy who will do invisible things. And this hand that nobody can see that pushes energy out of the nation, because we're evidently, I guess we don't need it. And we can truck out, we can rail car out thousands of trailer loads of coal every day to China. We can pump natural gas out because, hey, we have so much. We have an abundance. Yet I look at the gas prices going up, up, up. They tell me $4 by May, possibly $5 by summer. That's kind of coincidental, don't you think? Don't you think it's kind of coincidental that it's now rising as we're going towards election time? And I'll tell you, over the summer, it probably will hit $5. Unless the president does something like opening up the strategic reserve, which is what I would do. I would, just on any indiscriminate day, I would open it up and I would flood the market. So every one of those speculators, all those people who are driving this through the roof, they lose their behinds. Oh, I'll tell you, it's amazing stuff. Anyway, your calls, 1-888-520-RICK. Thoughts, questions, comments, something on your mind, 1-888-520-7425. So the number of people who are seeking unemployment benefits has fallen to the lowest point in almost 4 years. The latest signal that the job market is, well, steadily improving. Things are getting a little bit better. Applicants for benefits dropped 13,000 to 348,000, well below what the analysts were expecting. This is the fourth drop in 5 weeks. So things are moving in the right direction, however slowly. There's a lot we should be doing more. I still think, you know, we should be investing heavily, but we will see. The big deal today done on the payroll tax and on the unemployment, the righties losing their mind, completely losing their mind. I must have got 20 press releases from all the right-wing groups saying, this is a bad deal, it's horrible, we shouldn't do this. And you know why? Well, you know why? They know that if the recovery continues as slow as it's been, November is going to be real tough for them. November is going to be tough for them across the board because they've done nothing. And I think everybody has noticed and has taken quite good notice of they've done nothing. The Republicans have done everything they can do to stop the recovery. And I think people have figured this out, that, well, the party of no is the GOP. Because their only stake in this is we got to get that black guy out of the White House. And, you know, it may not be the greatest deal, but it's done. The payroll tax holiday is going to go on for the rest of the year, so small businesses across this country can breathe a sigh of relief that you're not going to have to go and have the accountant redo all of your payrolls and all of that. We have some certainty, something that the radical right seems to be so enthralled with. Well, we need to have certainty, and you're right. How about certainty in our tax code? And, you know, they keep talking about, well, we can't, the rich people in the country, they're not investing because they're not certain that their rates aren't going to go up. But it was okay that every working person in this country was going, are my rates going to go up? You know, it's mind-blowing. And this nonsense, well, they won't invest. Really? Really? Yeah, okay. How's that working out? I'm looking at Wall Street. It's more profitable than it's been in at least a decade. I mean, they are fat and happy. The profits are back. The champagne's popping, man. The only thing that's not happening is it's not trickling down. They've made sure that they're catching anything that falls out of the bottle so that you and I don't get any of it. So anyway, the deal, 73 weeks of unemployment benefits, that has cut it down from 99 weeks. Evidently, they're going to be drug testing unemployed people who have in the past tested positive for drugs or who are, I guess, seeking some kind of certain jobs, whatever that's going to be. I guess like truck drivers. I guess if you're a truck driver because you have to take random drug tests, I wonder if this is part of this bill. If you're a laid-off truck driver, will you have to take drug tests to get unemployment? Something I'm going to have to find out. Also, we're going to pay for it, and hey, good for them. We're going to pay for it on the back of the main whipping boy, the federal employees, and their pension. Also going to auction off some unused sectors of the broadband spectrum. Why not lease it? Why sell it? Also, $5 billion is going to be cut from preventative health care. So, hey, good. So that when we cut that $5 billion, it'll probably cost us $20 billion in the future. So there you go. So now that the deal is finalized, no crisis, what's next? Is this going to be the end of it? Does it mean there's anything else going to happen? Will Congress be content on running out the clock? you know, get into the election cycle. The legislative calendar is not that long. You know, maybe just run that out. You know, take it into the election. Well, according to Lindsey Graham, he told Politico that the chances of Congress dealing with any of the significant issues facing the nation probably zero. So I'm looking at our transportation bill, who Barbara Boxer, who is the sponsor of the Senate's version of the transportation bill, she said she didn't see a path forward. It's stalled. Evidently, they just, wow, just can't figure it out. Her bill, the Moving Ahead for Progress in the 21st Century bill, the MAP 21 bill, evidently done. There's nowhere to go, according to her. And this was the $109 billion transportation bill over 2 years. Now, I don't see the House bill going anywhere either, because Boehner has postponed that vote. That would have been a six-year, $260 billion transportation bill. But there was a whole bunch of insanity in there. So I'm guessing not going to happen. And what does that mean for us? What does that mean for workers? You know, I keep going, you know, they keep talking about jobs and they keep talking about, you know, uncertainty. You know what's uncertain? Am I, the bridge I drive over, is that going to collapse? I mean, at what point do we continue to defund our infrastructure? At what point does it come back and bite us in the behind? I mean, at some point we're going to start seeing I-35 happen across this country time and time again. And is that what we want? No. What I want is I want to be the Jetsons, man. I want to be investing in 21st century technology. I want to have the best airports and the best roads and bridges and public transportation system. I want to get away from gasoline. I would love to be able to take a train to work every day. Get a light rail in here. But that's not going to happen because the Republicans are dead set against any investment in public transportation. Dead set against it. And you even have, you know, I look here locally where they wanted to do this Corridor One project. Or even some of the Democrats, the boneheads that they are. Well, you know, we're not sure that it's a good investment. It's a great investment. Because you're going to, one, you're going to unclog the highways. You're going to get people off the roads. And two, you're going to have development around those corridors. You know, it's, well, and it's going to create jobs at a time when we need them the most. And I guess, you know, I go back to, you know, the black guy in the White House thing. I go back to McConnell saying we're going to make him a one-term president. I go back to Rush Limbaugh. I hope he fails. You know, and all of the other Republicans who have come out and said the things that they've said and the actions that they've taken that have led me to the final conclusion that they don't give a tinker's damn about this nation. They care about their political fortunes. That's it. The unemployment bill, the doc fix bill, the payroll tax holiday bill, whatever you want to call it, that got passed because they read the political tea leaves. If that didn't happen, there would have been a revolt of small businesses. People like me who go, what am I doing in a couple of weeks with my employee? And they read the tea leaves and said, they can't do it. They didn't want hundreds of thousands of people marching on their offices whose unemployment benefits ran out. They didn't want doctors revolting because, hey, you know what? We want to get paid a higher rate. So they did what they had to do. They had to go back on their position. But that doesn't mean they're going to do anything else. And I expect nothing really of any substance to get done. And this transportation bill, to me, is huge. It's something that we should be calling people daily, saying, look, there are hundreds of thousands of construction workers out of work right now. We should be putting them back to work immediately. And stop fighting over this Keystone XL thing. It's a couple of jobs. Put those people to work doing something that's going to benefit the country, going to improve our infrastructure, instead of trying to divide us with it. It's insanity. Anyway, going to take a quick break. When we come back, Kathleen Kleinman, CEO of TriPel, the Tri-County Patriots for Independent Living. She's going to be here talking about Governor Corbett's budget and what's that going to mean to the folks that she represents. Quick break, right back after this.
Where common sense, reason, and community come together. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. A new poll from United Technologies National Journal Congressional Connection shows strong opposition to making any cuts at all to Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. The poll also shows strong support among the American people for cutting the military budget. 76% of Americans say no cuts at all to Social Security. 80% say no cuts at all to Medicare. When it comes to military spending, 60% support some or a lot of cuts. Teamsters members at Hostess have overwhelmingly authorized a strike if Hostess is granted its court action to impose unfair contract terms as part of the bankruptcy process. Companies often use bankruptcy proceedings to destroy union contracts for workers while making sure that CEOs and other executives keep lavish compensation packages. The more than 7,500 Teamsters at Hostess have twice before made sacrifices to help the company. But the union says worker sacrifices need to be matched by sacrifices from other key stakeholders in the company. A hearing on the court action is set for March 5th. Florida corrections officers are praising the state Senate there for voting down a proposal to privatize more than two dozen prisons. The privatization proposal would have put thousands of Florida Department of Corrections employees out of work, according to the union representing corrections workers. Hundreds of corrections workers traveled to Florida's capital to urge lawmakers to kill the privatization bill. Ken Wood of Teamsters Local 2011 says his 20,000 corrections officers members are grateful that a bipartisan Senate majority voted against privatizing those prisons. Police unions in New York City are demanding that the city release data on the cancer rate among police who responded at Ground Zero right after the September 11th attacks. They want the data to get cancer added to the list of diseases covered by the federal Zadroga Act. The law compensates Ground Zero first responders for related health issues but omits cancer. New York's Patrolman's Benevolent Association says it has young men and women members dying from cancer at unusual rates for their ages, and it's unconscionable that the city won't release the data. A 1,000-mile trip is being planned for workers who have been locked out of both Cooper Tire and American Sugar plants. The trip starts in Fargo, North Dakota, where beet sugar workers were locked out 6 months ago. The Cooper Tire workers were locked out in late November. The workers will make stops in Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Indiana before ending the trip in Findlay, Ohio. Locking out workers during contract negotiations is becoming a common problem for American workers. Caterpillar, Healthbridge, and Manitowoc Crane have all locked out their employees in recent months. The CEO of American Sugar said in a secretly recorded meeting with shareholders that the lockout was part of a greater plan to break the back of the union. This newscast was made possible in part through underwriting support from the hardworking men and women of the IBEW, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
We need to cut the waste so we can keep taxes down and make sure we have money for critical programs that help our families and our seniors.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, rick@thericksmithshow.com. The best way to get a hold of me by email. Our quote of the day comes from Alan West, a Republican from Florida. He says, the Democratic appetite for ever-increasing redistributory handouts is, in fact, the most insidious form of slavery remaining in the world today. So, you know, the people who need help putting food on the table, those food stamps, that's slavery, according to our friend Alan West. Amazing stuff. And I look at the governor's budget, just kind of, in the year of the Bible, just kind of scratching my head. Anyway, I've got Kathleen Kleinman on the phone. She's the CEO of TriPel, the Tri-County Patriots for Independent Living. Their website, tripel.com. We've got a link at the Rick Smith Show.com. Just click on Kathleen Kleinman's name. Kathleen, thanks for taking time for me.
Thank you. Thank you. Great to be here.
Tell me, what is TriPill?
We actually pronounce it triple.
Okay.
We kind of warp it a little bit so it's easier. But we're a small nonprofit in Washington, Fayette, and Greene County, owned and operated by people with disabilities to help people with disabilities.
That sounds like a great thing. In fact, you know, giving folks who I've often claimed are at the margin and, you know, at the mercy of programs that, that you know, folks like Governor Corbett has cut, coming together and actually doing some lobbying, I think that's a great thing.
Yeah, we're very involved in the political scene, have been. We found prior administrations like the Ridge administration and the Rendell administration, somebody we could talk to, somebody we could sit down at the table when they needed to implement changes programmatically or even reduce budgets and save the state some tax dollars. When that happened, they would bring us to the table and include us in that planning. This time, it's not happening.
And what kind of effect is it happening on your members? You know, I'm looking at this budget, it's just devastating.
Yes, it is devastating. And there are some things that are not even revealed here because we took a 5% cut last year, that we took an intermediary 5% cut again just last month, which was retroactive back to July 1, and now they're telling us a 5% cut again. So what you see is a 5% cut, but it's a 15% cut, and in many cases it's more than that.
Yeah, I mean, but, you know, what do you say to the people, Kathleen, and go, you know, well, times are tough. We've all got to tighten our belt, and that means you too.
I'd say talk to the people. That's what I say. Talk to the people. Let us be at the table. If these cuts are real, if you really need to do this, sit down with us and plan for these cuts. Don't just take a hatchet.
You make a good point. If they're real, I mean, if we really need them, because I keep seeing our governor, he seems to love to give money away to corporations, seems to, you know, just loves to leave money on the table. I look at the impact fee tax, whatever it is, pathetic by national standards. I look at the Delaware loophole that we've left wide open. There are so many opportunities to raise revenue here in the state, yet he's chosen to go the opposite route and take it out on people who need it the most.
I mean, that is also true. Right now, we across Pennsylvania, we have a little cottage industry of small nonprofits providing services to the most vulnerable, people with severe disabilities. We do that on a shoestring. We even hire people with disabilities to provide services to people with disabilities, and that keeps them out of the welfare system. It keeps them off of the Social Security disability in many cases. So we put them to work helping each other. So we have a very tight network of nonprofits trying to do that. Well, we are about to be wiped off the map because there are some big corporations known by the term managed care, and they have very high salaries. They're generally not nonprofits, and they're going to be doing all our business in the future. So we understand who's going to lose. Where is the cost saving? The cost saving is the services to the people so that the salaries of the professionals get higher.
You got to love privatization. You know, I was talking to my producer before the program, and he said that evidently there's for folks who are on some of these programs, there's a $2 copay to go see a doctor. And if you don't pay the copay, is it true they take you to a magistrate? Is it possible to be locking up poor people? Are we going back to debtor's prison?
That is a new proposal put on the table by Governor Corbett. There has been the Medicaid system that if you just can't possibly get to a doctor or to a, let's say, a dialysis treatment, if there's no way possible for you to get there under your own power, the Medicaid system can find you eligible for a ride at the Medicaid cost. So you can't, you know, if you can't drive yourself, there's no public transportation available for you that you can use. There's always been, you know, a safety net to get you there. Well, for the first time in history, there will be a $2 copay for each trip each way. And many of these people are living on less than $650 a month, and they're going to have to come up with this additional $2 for each doctor's trip each way. If you're on dialysis, and you go to the doctors three times a week.
Yep. No, I remember.
Take that,
My grandfather went through the same thing. You know, he had dialysis three times a week, and you know, they sent a van out to come pick him up, took him back and forth. Didn't cost him anything. You know, I can't imagine, you know, if you're living on virtually nothing.
This program was only for the people who virtually have nothing. And now we're targeting the people we've already segregated out and saying, these people have nothing. So let's take something from them.
That's insane. And, you know, I remember back, you know, the Simpson-Bowles Commission, they called the Cat Food Commission. I guess we're going to start calling this guy the Cat Food Governor.
I like that.
I mean, because the reality is what you're doing is you're now, it's not only forcing people between food and medicine, it's forcing people between food, medicine, or getting to the doctor now. That's insanity.
That's right. And it's my understanding that this is the same, also, this is the governor that in the past, he filed a lawsuit to stop the Affordable Health Care Act from the feds coming to Pennsylvania. That lawsuit is still out there. It's our only hope.
Yeah, and I look at this and I go, you know, where are our priorities? And I don't know if you know, but here, 2012 is the year of the Bible. Evidently, our legislature saw fit to pass House Resolution 535, you know, saying that 2012 is the year of the Bible. And I look at that, and to me, that's a pretty powerful statement. That means we're going to take care of the poor, we're going to take care of the elderly, we're going to take care of the children, the sick, all of that. We're going to do those things. Yet I look at what the governor's budget said, and what you're telling me, I'm thinking we're reading Revelations.
Right. If he's worried about jobs, he's worried about the jobs of professionals. He's not worried about the jobs of the people who are the aides that take care of people. We have like 650 aides coming out of Triple here in southwestern PA that go to people's homes, who try to keep them out of institutions by making sure they're safe in their homes. And that workforce is very, very much threatened. We are trying to move towards unionization of those that workforce, because to this point in time, they've never been unionized. SEIU has reached out to us here in Washington Fay and Greene County, and we now have a labor contract. We're hoping that will help us. But maybe it's too late. Maybe we got to do more to get the whole state organized. But we need to make some progress. We've never been so threatened.
Yeah, I'm looking at this. Let me ask you about the aides who do the work, because I know those are extremely low-paying jobs, and chances are they probably don't even have health care themselves. They're administering health care. They're taking care of people, probably don't have it for themselves. Do they have health care for themselves?
They do not have health care.
See, again, you know, I go back to this whole thing about the Affordable Care Act. You know, while I don't think it's perfect, I think there's a lot we should have done better. It is a step in the right direction. And I don't see anybody on the other side of the aisle. I don't see anybody out there saying, well, here's a good alternative other than the old pay or die system. You have a job and you have health care, or you don't and you die.
We must have health care. We must. People are dying. We're paying too much also to keep people locked up in institutions. We have to keep them at home.
Yeah, and, you know, just yesterday we talked to a guy about the privatization scheme that went on down in Florida. Fortunately, that was stopped. But we're seeing that the privatization across the country on everything. And our cat food governor here, it's not a matter of if we should privatize. It's a matter of what and how much profit they can wring out of that.
Well, I will tell you, there's going to be a state rally on Wednesday, February 29th at 11 a.m. down to State Capitol Rotunda. People with disabilities are all coming together, and we're going to demand the governor pay attention and talk to us.
And that's why I think groups like yours, Triple, the Tri-County Patriots for Independent Living, I think so important. The website, triple.com, TRIPIL.com. We've got a link at the ricksmithshow.com. Just click on Kathleen Kleinman's name. While you're here at the Capitol, can you tell us what you got planned?
Well, we're going to talk about the fact that we who are consumers of these services need to be involved in talking about changes to these programs. We are talking about what the effect of waiting lists are, of how people die waiting on waiting lists for services, how people end up in institutions just because the home care services are not available. We're going to talk about why would you attack fraud and attack waste where there is none? They haven't found any in our home services. Why are they attacking us? Why are you building whatever infrastructure you're building on our back. And, you know, we're trying to get a dialogue going with the Republicans in the House and the Senate, and mostly with this governor.
Are you getting any feedback? Because look, you know, I'm not saying that they're evil. I just think that they're misguided. You know, and I think that this, well, maybe they're evil, but I won't expect you to go there. What kind of feedback are you getting, I guess, should be the first question.
Well, you know what? We're like I said, our people are very frightened. They people with disabilities who are living on the edge are very frightened. When we talk to our legislators, they don't have the sense that they know exactly what the master plan is or that they have any real input into that. That's why I'm saying we need the governor to tell us, you know, when he's going to hear what we say. When is he going to understand that even, you know, we can come to the table and talk about cuts and efficiencies if you want, but there are ways to do it and there are ways not to do it. And he's going to trample people in his process that he's doing now.
Yeah, you know, I look at this and I look at some of the situations that I've talked to people who are in, and, you know, I don't think people of power and privilege understand how dire, how desperate, and how fearful some folks are that they may not make it to tomorrow.
That's absolutely correct. But, you know, people do live longer when they're not in institutions. They do live longer at home. But people who are vulnerable and people who are disabled, they have to be politically active at this point in time. They have to.
And they should get in contact with groups like yours. Again, TRIPIL.com, the website. We've got a link at TheRickSmithShow.com. Just click on Kathleen Kleinman's name. Kathleen, I appreciate the time. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Let's take a quick break. Back with your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
All right. Just make us be brave. Make us play nice. Let us be together tonight.
Thought-provoking, intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class, Rick Smith. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
In my state of Texas, things tend to be bigger. Bigger hats, bigger money, and bigger thievery by political con men. Last year, the gang of GOP hucksters who control our state government pulled off a huge heist, covering it up with an equally huge boast. We balanced our budget, not by raising taxes, but by cutting government spending, bragged the gang leader, Governor Rick Perry. How'd they fill the $27 billion shortfall that they themselves had created by their previous budgetary mismanagement? By stealing money from already poorly funded programs, from education to parks, that ordinary Texans count on. People here are justly proud of their 94 parks, but many are now understaffed, open fewer hours, and in disrepair, because the Perryites whacked the system's budget by 21.5%. But that was only part of the robbery. A state sales tax on sporting goods, dedicated by law to help finance the people's parks, will generate about $236 million this year and next. But the governor and his legislative henchmen also raided this pile of revenue, filching two-thirds of it for the state's general fund so they could claim that they balanced our budget without raising taxes. To replenish some of the money taken by the Perry gang, the great state of Texas is now engaged in a shocking spectacle. Public begging. In a video played at 11 December press conferences in state parks across Texas, the chief of our parks department is reduced to shaking a tin cup, pleading for $4.6 million in donations. Please act now to help keep our state parks open for all Texans to enjoy, he beseeches. This is Jim Hightower saying, how pathetic. Right-wing politicians across our country howl that they want to shrink government. But they are the shrunken ones, and the narrowness of their vision is diminishing what it means to be American.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
One of these days I'm going to blow my top, and that sucker, he's going to pay. Lord, I can't wait to see their faces when I get the nerve to say... job and shove it. I ain't working
here. And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Of the 54% of Michigan voters who saw Pete Hoekstra's Super Bowl ad, 45% of them said that they're less likely to vote for good old Pete. And the last I saw, the polling numbers had Debbie Stabenow, the current senator, up 14 points thanks to the ad he aired. And if you remember, this was it.
Thank you, Michigan Senator Debbie Stabenow. Debbie spends so much American money. You borrow more and more from us. Your economy gets very weak. Ours get very good. We take your jobs. Thank you, Debbie Stabenow.
Yeah, that was it. And he goes on, I'm Pete Stabenow, the old nonsense. Well, evidently that girl, her name's Lisa Chan, 21-year-old Asian-American actress, she has come out and apologized. She said, I'm deeply sorry for any pain that the character I portrayed brought my communities. She said, I hope I can be forgiven. I feel horrible about my participation, and I am determined to resolve my actions. And the Asian American Action Fund, they said the ad was reminiscent of Asian prostitutes saying, me love you long time in Hollywood films. Hoekstra thought, it was funny. It was just satire. Oh, just funny. Oh, yeah. Well, good for you, Pete, and goodbye. Anyway, I go back to what Alan West said. This idea that Democrats have an appetite for ever-increasing redistributory handouts, saying the fact that it's the most insidious form of slavery. And, you know, I think back, and as I was talking to Kathleen Kleinman there, I was thinking back to when I injured my hip, because I really screwed up my hip. I punched about a half-dollar size hole in the cartilage that lines the inside of your hip. And they're saying, well, you're going to have to replace it. And I'm going, well, that's not going to happen. And there was a time of despair there where I'm sitting there going, you know, I'm on workman's comp. What am I going to do? Workman's comp in this state has a cap of 10 years, and then there's a whole bunch of nonsense that goes on along with that, and you always know that the legislature is always going to come after you, not to mention the insurance companies, the employer, and all of that. You're just going to be attacked from every angle. And fortunately, I have other skills, and I had, you know, other opportunities, so I got out of it. But I think of those couple of days when I was deciding, what am I going to do? I'm screwed. And I think of these folks who really are screwed. They don't have the ability to get up and go do something else. Most of them are wheelchair bound or home bound, and they need help. And there's no pulling themselves up by their bootstraps. These are the folks at the bottom. And you have got a governor who's, and the fact that $2 sounds like nothing to you and me. Okay, $2 to pay for the bus ride to get to your dialysis, or $2 to get to your doctor appointment. Doesn't sound like a lot to you and me. But like she said, when you're living on $600 a month and $500 of it goes to rent and utilities and everything else, $2, that's the difference between whether you eat or not. And I've always said, you know, you stop and think about this. And you hear people talk about we're this great Christian nation and how it's the year of the Bible and nonsense like that. And yet you see in a budget, a moral document, the document that shows what your priorities are, where your morality, where your values are, you see cuts to programs that benefit the wildly wealthy, that benefit the big corporations, that benefit people who don't need it at the expense of those who do. And I go back to that time where I was in despair. I was going, you know, I got three kids. I got bills. What am I going to do? And I cannot fathom being in a position where you have no opportunities. You have no choice. You have only the ability to take what's given or what beating comes your way, which is why it's appalling to me when you see a budget that goes after those folks, when you see someone like West saying, well, you know, it's the most insidious form of slavery, when there's still slavery going around in this world. The International Labor Organization, they've reported that, a good number, more than 12 million workers around this world are forced to work every day. They're forced into their labor. There's no choice there. That's slavery. And that more than 12 million number, that's not even the people who are in the underground sex trade, who are forced into that. According to the folks at the United Nations Global Initiative to Fight Human Trafficking, they estimate that the profits annually from forced trafficking, somewhere around $32 billion a year. That, Alan West, that is insidious. That's the most insidious form of slavery. Helping people in their time of need, helping people when they're down, I'm missing that. Somehow that must have, in my Catholic upbringing and all the catechism classes that I took and all of that, somehow I must have missed how helping the poor and helping the sick and helping the aged, somehow I missed how that was a form of slavery. Must have missed that. Must have missed how helping feed children and feed families. Must have missed how that was the most insidious form of slavery. Must have missed it. Because I think most people, the vast majority of people, want to do like most of us have the opportunity to get up every day, go to work that pays a reasonable wage, have a decent life that you can put a roof over your head, feed your kids, have opportunity for the future. And yet all I keep seeing, and it's amazing to me, the job creators that we're told if we give them enough, it never seems to be enough. They have this insatiable appetite for more. And, you know, Gordon Gekko was right. I guess they think greed is good. That's the mantra. The more that they can put in their pockets, the more they can take from you, the more redistributory handouts that we can give them, somehow they think that's the way to go. And I'm debtor's prisons. I'm thinking of debtor's prisons. You heard her say it. They can take you to a magistrate. And is the magistrate going to throw a woman in a wheelchair in jail? Or a man in a wheelchair in jail? I sure hope not. But are we going back to that? Will we see the debtors' prisons? I know the Republicans, you know, in the 2010 election, there were some that were saying, hey, maybe we should be locking some of those poor people up. Teach them hygiene skills, as the one guy said. Like somehow, if you need food stamps to help feed your family, you have a deficiency with hygiene. I mean, really? Are they going there? And the answer is yeah, because they've got the money. They've got the money to keep pushing this frame, to keep pushing this mean. And you look at yesterday, the Heartland Institute, they leaked out the documents for them. And we knew who was funding them. Everybody knew. You just confirmed it. We know who's behind all these attacks. We're just confirming it. And, you know, it's all about the cheap labor. It's all about exploitation. It's all, you know, it's no longer about money, I think, for them anymore. It's more about power. You look at these billionaires who are behind these presidential candidates. It's not about their, I don't even know if it's about policy anymore. It's about, hey, did you see what my presidential candidate did while they're at their cocktail parties or while they're at their Koch brother retreats where they decide how they're going to divvy up the nation? There's something seriously wrong when you're talking about a handful, you know, 100 people getting in a room somewhere deciding how they're going to divvy up our nation and use our government to do it. Why? Because they've got the money. And I go back to Alan West, the most insidious form of slavery. You want to talk about an insidious form of slavery? Look at the people who make all of these little gadgets that we love. All the little, and I'd say cheap gadgets, but this iPhone I've got, it ain't cheap. This could be made here in the U.S. The difference is I don't think any worker in this country would put up with the conditions that the workers in that country have to put up with And when we come back, I want to talk a little bit about that. Quick break, your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Stick around. You're going to want to stick around for this. Back after this.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
People often ask us how to see a green flash.
The green flash is an optical phenomenon that you can see shortly after sunset or before sunrise. It happens when the sun is almost entirely below the horizon, with the barest edge of the sun, the upper edge, still visible.
For a second or two, that upper rim of the sun will appear green in color. It's a brief flash of the color green, the legendary green flash. It's really very exciting to see, especially if you've been looking for one. And it said that once you've seen a green flash, you'll never again go wrong in matters of the heart.
To see a green flash, you need two things. First, a clear day with no haze or clouds near the horizon. Next, you need a distant horizon with a distinct edge. You can see the green flash from a mountaintop or high building, but it's most often seen over the ocean by people on beaches or in boats.
Here's something really important. When you're looking for a green flash, don't look at the sun until it's nearly entirely below the horizon. If you do, you'll dazzle or even damage your eyes. Plus, you'll ruin your green flash chances for that day. For more, come to earthsky.org and search for the words green flash. I'm Deborah Bird.
And I'm Jorge Salazar. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science. We're at earthsky.org.
Exposing that free trade is never free. The Rick Smith Show.
And what is the true meaning of that? Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind? Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com, or you give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. So like I said, you know, all those gadgets we get, all those cheap gadgets they tell us, oh, you know, we need global trade because we get cheap stuff. But, you know, this iPhone was not cheap. The iPad, not cheap. A lot of this high-end electronics, not cheap. So who's pocketing all the money? Well, I think as Jim emailed me during the break, he said they want it all, Rick. They have no sense of compassion and basic human decency. They want it all. It's all about the money. It's all about the profit. And this article written by a guy named Alex Pasternak, titled Foxconn's Other Dirty Secret, the World's Largest Internship Program, kind of made me think about the J-1 visa program. Here in the Hershey area. And his article goes into the fact that in 2010, this one place had 17 suicide attempts and 13 deaths just at this one place. And it goes into the fact that what they're saying is there's some 430,000 interns who work at this place. And he goes into the fact that the government, along with the schools, and it's this whole big program, the government and these schools and these companies all work together, and they put these kids into internship programs because, you know, the journalist guy or the guy who wants to be a doctor, he needs to know how to put little glass plates in the iPhone. But they've got this flood of really cheap, really exploitable labor. And he goes into how, you know, if you don't go and do your 3 months every year of internship, I call it what you want, slavery, internship, same kind of thing, that you might not get your degree. And, you know, it's a way to have an immediate workforce, a cheap workforce. And I go back to the article that a couple of weeks ago the New York Times had, talking about how the woman who's the communications person for Apple says, well, you know, they can get 8,000 people out in, you know, in an hour and a half and get them on the lines and get them to working. And you start to look at this whole internship scam. When you can have in a year some 430,000 cheap laborers just hanging around, that sometimes you pay, I guess sometimes you don't, according to them. It's kind of scary. How are you going to compete with that? And what they're saying is, it's, you know, most internships are voluntary. At least we think so here in this country. So when you hear you're doing an internship, you know, you think, oh, I'm going to, you know, maybe make copies or do something stupid to hang around to put something on my resume. No, these people they're forced into factory work. And like over here at Hershey, I'm trying to figure out, explain to me exactly how it is loading boxes into a truck is a cultural exchange. Same thing with this quote-unquote internship. Explain to me how it is someone who's in medicine or any other field other than electronics is going to benefit from working in a factory. Even the people working in a factory are working on electronics degrees. How is an assembly line job going to help you in your quest for knowledge? Probably not. So all you really are is cheap, exploitable labor. And, you know, you go through this and you look at the fact that, you know, these iPhones are not cheap, but you've got all of this exploitable labor going, well, what's happening? Well, it's ending up in the pockets of Apple. Why is their stock so high? Well, gee, do you need to think about that? And he goes through the stories of, you know, a whole bunch of people who are in these situations where the government says you have to go. And if you don't go, you have to get out. You're done. You're out of school. That's the end of it. And one of the people said it's like a concentration camp for workers of the 21st century. You got students who are kidnapped and basically working overtime in the name of just-in-time production. And I go back to that article. I go back to that article in the New York Times where they said, you know, we can call up 8,000 people just like that. And you wonder how. Let's go to the phones. I got Jim on line one. How you doing today, Jim?
Okay. How you doing, Rick?
I'm good.
Listen, that Foxconn is something else, isn't it? I understand they have to put nets around the building to prevent people from jumping out of the building because they've had so many suicide attempts. Is that right?
Yeah, well, like I said, you know, they had 17 in 2010, and 13 succeeded.
Good Lord. I mean, and this type of internship, that's kind of like interning in the Hitler Youth, isn't it?
Well,
reverse.
Yeah, I mean, but what it is it's slave labor, and you know,
or the German workforce that Hitler had.
Yeah, well, I guess you could go there. Sure,
that's exactly what he did with people. They had mandatory call up for work service like that. If you didn't go, they put you in a labor camp.
And that's exactly what's going on here with these internships. They're holding these kids' futures over their heads. They're not paying them. The conditions are deplorable. In fact, I think they said there was, in a 2-square-kilometer patch of land, there are 300,000 people. And in every dorm room, you've got at least 10 people living in each dorm room. I mean, they're saying it's more dense than the densest population place of Manila. Manila has the highest density of any city in the world. They're saying this is three times as dense as that.
What's the difference between this situation and that of a concentration camp?
Well, nothing. And that's what they were saying. This is the concentration camp of workers of the 21st century.
And well, I tuned in late and I didn't hear this, but I mean, you know, it just sounds like something out of either Soviet gulag or a Nazi concentration camp to me.
Well, this is a communist nation, after all. Our friends, our trading partners. At least that's what they tell me.
Well, that's what they tell us, but I think we'll see one day exactly what kind of friends they really are once they get the upper hand, and they already have the upper hand.
Yeah, and, you know, we have, and what bothers me, Jim.
And we've given it to them.
Exactly. It wasn't that they beat us, it's that we handed it to them. In fact, we did it willingly and with a big smile. All
yeah,
why?
When did this start? Under Clinton, when they started making all these arrangements to send this stuff overseas, or was it before Clinton?
I mean, I guess you could go back to Nixon, but it really started under Clinton, and it was just full pedal to the metal during the Bush years. Once they figured out they could get cheap, exploitable labor. I don't believe this is party ideology. This is the business-friendly model, because both parties are as guilty as the other of we need to be more business-friendly, we need to do what business wants. And I got to be honest, to me, that's it.
Well, I think you're right, and I think it's deplorable what's happened. And I don't see, and they're not going to surrender this type of policy either, as long as it makes them money, because they don't care where the money comes from, as long as their bank accounts are enriched daily. They don't care about human misery or, as I said before, they have no sense of decency or human compassion. They don't.
Do you think the Romneys of the world give a rat's behind about some working person anywhere on the planet? The answer is no.
No, they had this thing on the Internet webpage, on the MSN webpage, about how mean Romney is. It was just a blurb I saw pass by when I was finding your show.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just incredible. I mean, this guy has as much compassion for his less and betters than he has no sense of compassion as far as I'm concerned. None of them do, Rick. Hell, a whole lot of those sneaking Republicans.
I'm right there with you.
They're up there vying for public office, like Gingrich and all these other people.
Every one of them.
Yeah, I mean, to me, they're a blight upon the face of this country.
But here's the sad thing, Jim. We keep voting. There are people who vote these people into office. We cannot get rid of this scum. We can't get rid of the scourge of the earth because they've got the money behind them, and they're the ones out there with these negative attack ads and all of this that, you know, most people are trying to just make it in this world.
Let me ask you one quick question. I know I have to get off here. Have you ever tried to talk to some of these people who vote for these guys?
All the time.
Have you and have you noticed exactly what their reaction is? You know, it's like you're saying something that's horribly anti-religious or
God, guns, and gays.
Pardon me?
God, guns, and gays. That's the reason most of the people I know who vote for these people, that's their line of thinking. It's religion, it's God's Second Amendment, or it's I hate gay people.
And they've been so dumbed down that they don't know any better. And to tell you the truth, these people will labor like scholars over the tenets of their own lack of compassion. And every one of them would have snored right through the Sermon on the Mount.
Absolutely. Jim, I appreciate the call. Thanks so much. You're so spot on. Call back again real soon.
Thank you.
You know, and I look at this, and the last point I want to make on this before we move on is the Chinese Minister of Education. He emphasized the fact in a report that they had in 2011 that the nation's goal of education was to supply skilled workers to the distressed labor market. Stop and think about the rhetoric that we're hearing now. We need to get those workers trained. We need to get education trained for the jobs. Not training people to be critical thinkers, not training people to become educated. No. We need bodies. We need robots to feed the machine. That, my friends, should scare the hell out of all of us. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
This is WFTE 90.3 FM Mount Cobb and W289 AU 105.7 FM Scranton, Pennsylvania. Listen to us throughout Northeast Pennsylvania or check us out on the web at WFTE.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. A new poll from United Technologies National Journal Congressional Connection shows strong opposition to making any cuts at all to Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid.
The poll also shows strong support among the American people for cutting the military budget. 76% of Americans say no cuts at all to Social Security. 80% say no cuts at all to Medicare. When it comes to military spending, 60% support some or a lot of cuts. Teamsters members at Hostess have overwhelmingly authorized a strike if Hostess is granted its court action to impose unfair contract terms as part of the bankruptcy process. Companies often use bankruptcy proceedings to destroy union contracts for workers while making sure that CEOs and other executives keep lavish compensation packages. The more than 7,500 Teamsters at Hostess have twice before made sacrifices to help the company. But the union says worker sacrifices need to be matched by sacrifices from other key stakeholders in the company. A hearing on the court action is set for March 5th. Florida corrections officers are praising the state Senate there for voting down a proposal to privatize more than two dozen prisons. The privatization proposal would have put thousands of Florida Department of Corrections employees out of work, according to the union representing corrections workers. Hundreds of corrections workers traveled to Florida's capital to urge lawmakers to kill the privatization bill. Ken Wood of Teamsters Local 2011 says his 20,000 corrections officers members are grateful that a bipartisan Senate majority voted against privatizing those prisons. Police unions in New York City are demanding that the city release data on the cancer rate among police who responded at Ground Zero right after the September 11th attacks. They want the data to get cancer added to the list of diseases covered by the federal Zadroga Act. The law compensates Ground Zero first responders for related health issues but omits cancer. New York's Patrolman's Benevolent Association says it has young men and women members dying from cancer at unusual rates for their ages, and it's unconscionable that the city won't release the data. A 1,000-mile trip is being planned for workers who have been locked out of both Cooper Tire and American Sugar plants. The trip starts in Fargo, North Dakota, where beet sugar workers were locked out 6 months ago. The Cooper Tire workers were locked out in late November. The workers will make stops in Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Indiana before ending the trip in Findlay, Ohio. Locking out workers during contract negotiations is becoming a common problem for American workers. Caterpillar, HealthBridge, and Manitowoc Crane have all locked out their employees in recent months. The CEO of American Sugar said in a secretly recorded meeting with shareholders that the lockout was part of a greater plan to break the back of the union. This newscast was made possible in part through underwriting support from the hardworking men and women of the IBEW, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Don't really care about the economy. Don't care much about democracy. I'm a member of the GOP. Trying to form a plutocracy. But if I can just bamboozle you, and you'll share my narrow point of view. What a wonderful world this
Ah, yes, indeed, a wonderful, wonderful world. And if all we had to worry about was, you know, what politician was going to give us what talking point, and that's how we lived our lives, it would be that much better. And I, for those of you listening on WXPI up north, your representative has the tweet of the day, Representative Tom Marino. He says, today's the third anniversary of the failed stimulus. You know, all those jobs that were created the last couple of months, stopping the massive job losses of January, February of 2009. Somehow that was a failure, according to Mr. Marino. Anyway, House Energy and Commerce Committee Chairman Fred Upman, he's leading a year-long Republican witch hunt on the Solyndra thing. Never mind the fact that in the past, he had pressed Energy Secretary Stephen Chu for multiple loan guarantees for Michigan solar companies. Never mind that, especially one that just filed bankruptcy this past Tuesday. Never mind that. And the guy who's leading the witch hunt, ISA, never mind that he had asked for loans as well. Kind of amazing. Anyway, the Subcommittee on Commerce, Manufacturing, and Trade held its first in what it says will be a series of articles where the jobs are. Now remember, November 2010, laser-like focus, jobs, jobs, jobs. Now we're finally getting to maybe a job somewhere. Anyway, yesterday's hearing was to focus on employment trends and analysis, and John Schmidt, senior economist at the Center for Economic and Policy Research, was one of the witnesses. John, thanks for taking time for me.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm good. You know, instead of being one of the witnesses, it kind of looked like it was an inquisition.
Well, it wasn't so bad.
Because, you know, I looked at some of the things that they, you know, they're going after you over, especially the one guy, this uncertainty. I wish in God's name you'd tell me where the uncertainty was. McKinley, I think is the name.
We're running out of time, but I've got a lot. So all I'm asking is, please, if you could submit where in God's name you came up with the idea that uncertainty is not a problem to manufacturers, I'd sure like to read it.
Yeah, I heard that, and I go, well, what do you say, John? The same answer you gave him.
Well, hopefully even a better answer, and now I've had a chance to sort of catch my breath. But I think the key issue is that the folks on the committee don't seem to distinguish between all of the kinds of uncertainty that are out there that businesses deal with all the time. You know, whether it's a question of, you know, what the exchange rate for the dollar is going to be if you're in manufacturing, that matters a lot. What's going to happen in terms of interest rates in the short term and the long term, that matters for your investments. You know, what your customers are going to be wanting to buy a year or 5 years from now. You know, what strategic decisions your competitors are going to make. There's a ton of uncertainty out there. And what they focus on is this one narrow bit of uncertainty, which is around government regulation. And kind of blow that up and make it sound as though, you know, the American economy is somehow being held hostage by these decisions about some kinds of regulations that the federal government's going to make. And it's just, there's just no evidence for it. I'm sure there are some companies that sometimes get on the wrong side of the law and that causes some problems. There's just no evidence that this is a general problem for the economy overall.
Yeah, I would think the uncertainty would be, am I going to have customers? And especially, you know, as they've continued to hold the payroll tax extensions hostage, as they've continued to do a lot of the things that they've done, taking it down to the wire, that's more uncertainty than I think most of the regulations.
Yeah, exactly. I think the absolute biggest problem facing American businesses, American workers right now is a lack of demand in the economy. There's just no way around it.
So, you know, you go back and you look at the stimulus, and, you know, Tom Marino said, oh, it's failed. And I go, I think it's actually done what it was supposed to do, what most economists said it was going to do. I wish it was bigger back then. I wish we'd have been more ambitious and a little more bold. Probably have been a lot further along. But for what we did, I think it worked pretty well.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I mean, whether it's the Congressional Budget Office or whether it's Wall Street analysts who do this for a living, everybody agrees that the stimulus program that was put through created millions of jobs, and there's just no doubt about that. I completely agree with you as well that the only thing that could have been better is if the stimulus had been a lot bigger. That's what we needed. We had a much higher unemployment rate than we could actually tackle with what we decided to spend.
You know, Representative Guthrie had something interesting to say. I'll just play the clip here because I find it just kind of amusing.
The question is, we haven't recovered that quickly, and are we putting in prescriptions and policies and regulations and borrowing 40 cents to imply, borrowing 40 cents of every dollar to have a school teacher in a classroom? Is that hurting our recovery? I know that we're moving in the right direction, but we would move far greater if we'd gone down the path that they did in the early 80s. I mean,
so, you know, I got two things that jump out at me. He says, you know, should we not be hiring teachers because we really, I guess, don't really care about the future. But he admits the recovery is working. We're going in the right direction. For a Republican, I think that's huge.
Yeah, it was pretty breathtaking to hear somebody say that we shouldn't be hiring teachers at a time when state and local governments are laying off big chunks of their labor force. And it's one of the worst spots in the labor force right now. The other issue, though, is, you know, this comparison to the 1980s recession and recovery. Which I think is really misleading. If you look at the current recovery and you look at private sector growth in the current recovery, it is actually better than private sector growth in the 2001 recovery. And it's actually pretty much on course with where we were in 1990-91. You know, we have a long way to go, and we're not out of the woods by any stretch, but we're actually doing at least as well right now as we did in the last two recovery periods. So.
Yeah, and the other the teacher issue kept coming up, I guess. You know, I look at Representative Bill Cassidy from Louisiana who said, well, you know, the problem is with blue collar employment. We need to get blue collar people working. We don't need teachers and PhDs. Evidently having them employed doesn't help blue collar workers, according to Representative Cassidy.
Yeah. No, I think it's very clear that we have a very broad recession that has hit workers across the board. Construction obviously was hurt bad to begin with. And manufacturing was hurt badly as well, but it's across the board. And now the biggest area for problems is in the public sector. So we need to support that. And obviously, we do need to get blue-collar workers back to work, and that's one reason why the president and a lot of the Democrats and even a few Republicans are standing behind the idea that we should have a big expansion of investment in infrastructure, whether it's public, transportation, roads, or improving our public schools and the infrastructure that they have.
You know, looking politically, though, you know, from some of the indications that I've seen today, it looks like nothing's going to get done for this legislative session. Everybody's pretty much saying, well, that's the end of, I think Boxer came out today and said the transportation thing's probably stalled, it's probably not going anywhere. And I'm going, you know, what happened to 2010, the laser-like focus on jobs?
It's very depressing, the current situation. I mean, we're going to do the minimal amount to extend unemployment benefits. It looks like we're going to do the minimum amount to extend the payroll tax, but any bigger steps, anything that could take us closer to full employment at a reasonable pace, seem to be off the table right now.
I mean, but we understand. I mean, even Republicans understand, because what's his name? Stephen LaTourette, the Republican from Ohio, says you put people back to work in infrastructure, investments in infrastructure, 42,000 jobs for every $1 billion invested. That number may be a little bit high, but that was his number.
Yeah, no, I think that's on target. These are the kind of labor-intensive jobs, and not just labor-intensive, but also labor-intensive and good quality jobs for the most part, higher wages and decent benefits often. That's exactly the kind of thing we need to get out of the mess we're in.
Representative McKinley, he said something that caught me, and this is something I really wanted to focus on. Listen to what he had to say.
Here we had for the San Francisco Bridge. They didn't use American steel. And it was so flawed that we had to send inspectors over to remake a lot of that steel. But yet, because it was lowest price, they were able to buy that from China. Our turbines for our wind turbines are coming from overseas. We've got even the Keystone Pipeline, from what I've heard from testimony, that wasn't even manufactured. The steel didn't come from America.
So when I hear this, the first thing that pops out at me is, you said, we got the lowest price, the cheapest deal. Are you surprised that it was crap?
Well, I mean, for me, what's surprising to me is that he's talking about this as a case of uncertainty. This is not a case of uncertainty. This is a case of the people that were sitting in that room that day in the House of Representatives had voted to approve these trade agreements. They had pushed them through, supported them, and this is not uncertainty at all. This is absolute certainty. We know that the law actually requires that we use the cheapest source, no matter where it comes from, and that puts the problems on the, puts us exactly in the situation that he's concerned about, and it has nothing to do with uncertainty.
But, you know, I understand the uncertainty argument, but you would think a U.S. representative would go, at least have the knowledge to say, well, cheapest probably isn't better if you have to go back and redo it and redo it and redo it. Maybe we should be looking at laws that say, well, the best value, maybe something.
Yeah, no, I agree with you there. Yep.
Because I keep hearing these stories. We're importing all of this stuff. We're getting all this stuff from low-wage, low-cost areas. And the reason it's low-wage, low-cost is because it's crap.
Yeah, I think we really are constrained right now by the whole set of trade agreements that we've signed over the last 20 years. And Republicans and Democrats have signed those agreements and supported them. Often, obviously, there are folks on both sides of the aisle that oppose those agreements, but they have not prevailed. And I think, you know, as the president said in 2008 when he was running for office, you know, it's really time to reconsider some of those deals and reopen them and think about how we can do the best job. Unfortunately, like so many promises around trade, they are made during the election and then forgotten as soon as anybody's elected.
Yeah, I sat 20 feet away from President Obama when he said, trust me, there will be strong labor and environmental and law restrictions in every trade agreement. And we got what we get, Colombia, South Korea, Panama.
Yeah, no, it's very disheartening. Our efforts to protect the U.S. manufacturing sector and to grow, have it grow, and to make it an opportunity for people to have good quality jobs, I think have really experienced a setback with respect to trade agreements over the last two decades.
So did you get a sense when you were sitting there talking to these guys? Because I go back to November of 2010, and the Republicans, you know, they told us, I got the pledge here on my desk. Laser-like focus on jobs. And here we are, well, you know, almost to the next election, and now they decide to hold a hearing on where the jobs are?
I got the impression that there was a laser-like focus on the concerns about profits of large employers in the economy, not a focus at all on where the job opportunities for workers are. And that, to me, was very disconcerting. I mean, it was really, it wasn't surprising, I guess, but it certainly was upsetting.
You know, at one point, I forget who it was, but, you know, he was talking about uncertainty, as you said, and he kept going back to it because evidently the drillers are telling him there's some uncertainty. You know, not anybody else, but, you know, the drillers are telling him, so he must know.
Yeah, no, there's a real tendency, I think, and in Congress to argue from anecdotes. So if a person talked to somebody in their district who said that they were having trouble dealing with a particular regulation, there's a belief that somehow that's completely generalizable. My question would be, first of all, why is the regulation there? I mean, it might be that we really want that regulation. You know, the cigarette industry was not in favor of limiting cigarette sales to kids. That was a regulation that hurt their business and probably got them some jobs. But, you know, when we take a full look at it, we say, yeah, it makes sense that we don't want to sell cigarettes to kids. But, you know, more generally, you know, how generalizable are these issues of individual constituents? And we just don't see any evidence in the economy overall that the problem people face is regulation now. What we do see consistently is the problem people face, that businesses face, that workers face, is a lack of demand.
Yep, and a lack of money in people's pockets.
Exactly.
John Schmidt, I appreciate the time, and congratulations. I guess that was your first testimony, correct?
That's right. Thank you.
I thought you did fantastic. Thanks so much. Let's take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Right back.
Your proud defender of the working class majority, Rick Smith.
In my state of Texas, things tend to be bigger. Bigger hats, bigger money, and bigger thievery by political con men. Last year, the gang of GOP hucksters who controlled our state government pulled off a huge heist, covering it up with an equally huge boast. We balanced our budget, not by raising taxes, but by cutting government spending, bragged the gang leader, Governor Rick Perry. How'd they fill the $27 billion shortfall that they themselves had created by their previous budgetary mismanagement? By stealing money from already poorly funded programs, from education to parks, that ordinary Texans count on. People here are justly proud of their 94 parks, but many are now understaffed, open fewer hours, and in disrepair, because the Perryites whacked the system's budget by 21.5%. But that was only part of the robbery. A state sales tax on sporting goods, dedicated by law to help finance the people's parks, will generate about $236 million this year and next. But the governor and his legislative henchmen also raided this pile of revenue, filching two-thirds of it for the state's general fund so they could claim that they balanced our budget without raising taxes. To replenish some of the money taken by the Perry Gang, the great state of Texas is now engaged in a shocking spectacle. Public begging. In a video played at 11 December press conferences in state parks across Texas, the chief of our parks department is reduced to shaking a tin cup, pleading for $4.6 million in donations. Please act now to help keep our state parks open for all Texans to enjoy, he beseeches. This is Jim Hightower saying, how pathetic. Right-wing politicians across our country howl that they want to shrink government. But they are the shrunken ones, and the narrowness of their vision is diminishing what it means to be American.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
When you wake up in the morning, do you care about the price of gold?
Well, I pay attention to the price of gold, but I think it reflects a lot of things. It reflects global uncertainties. I think the reason people hold gold is as a protection against what we call tail risk, really, really bad outcomes. And to the extent that the last few years have made people more worried about potential of a major crisis, then they have gold as a protection.
Do you think gold is money?
No.
No.
It's not money.
It's been
money for 6,000 years, somebody reversed that and eliminated that economic law.
Yeah, that economic law. We should just take that little part because it sounds like a commercial. Do you think gold is money? Wow. Jeez. And you know, the sad reality is he probably won the main caucus. They're saying that Romney won by 194 votes. But increasingly, as you're looking at the outcome, it looks like Paul probably won. And there was some shenanigans going on there. That scares me. That scares me more than if they voted. I don't know who's crazier, to be honest, Santorum or Paul. And someone said to me the other night, boy, I'm sure hoping Rick Santorum becomes the Republican nominee. Sure hope that happens so that Obama have a nice, easy time. And I go, hey, remember 1980? Remember when the Carter people wanted Reagan? Because Reagan at the time was insane. And look what we ended up with. And look at the path that we're on. I don't want in 30 years my kids going, what in the hell were you thinking? I don't want to have to answer that question. I really don't. Because look, we're Christian Iran then. I mean, we're a Christian version of Iran if Santorum becomes president. Pretty simple stuff. He was out today yesterday. He was talking to seniors. And he says, how many seniors want what Congress has for health care? And all the people said, yeah, me, yay. And he said that, you know, Obama and his people, they don't want you to have what they have because they're elitist snobs. And they're looking down their nose at average Americans. And he hit the other talking point because you folks in Idaho, you live in flyover America. And they don't care about you. They just look down their nose. And I'm going, wow, good for you. I mean, hitting all the talking points. It's great. The only problem is, you know, if you were to do what he wants to do, and which is what Paul Ryan wants to do, the plan is to voucherize health care so that you can go through the federal employee health benefit plan or whatever the book that they'll give you. And say, I've got $10,000. What plan can I buy? How little health care can I get for 10 grand? Or whatever the number is going to be for seniors. And understand, my grandmother, 84 years old, 10 grand probably wouldn't get her a policy to cover toe cleanings or anything because she's had some problems. And we as a society decided Medicare was important. We need to give people health care when they need it. But his idea is, you know, make them go out into the private market, you know, the one that the federal employees, the people in Congress get, which is a great punchline because we always think that they've got the gold-plated plans when the reality is they've got the standard plans that most other people have. They can choose from any list of a whole bunch of them, how much they want to pay out of their pocket to get the better plans, which is something that, you know, they don't really want to talk about. But Princeton economist Hugh Reinhardt, he said it's a great idea, except there's one big difference between the plan that Congress gets and Medicare. There's two big differences. Under the federal plan, people in Congress, they're indexed differently than the people in Medicare. Medicare is tied to the Consumer Price Index, which has not in any way kept up with healthcare costs. Congress, they've got one that's tied to making sure that they are taken care of. And then they're not paying more and more. So what? Understand how this is going to work out. Granny, listen. This is how it's going to work out. They're going to give you that voucher, and today it's going to be okay. And next year it's going to cost you a little bit more. Next year it's going to cost you a little bit more, and a little bit more, and a little bit more, until eventually 5, 6, 8, 10 years down the road, you can't afford it. And then you're going, oh, my goodness. I have to decide between can I get a ride to the doctor that they're charging me a copay for, or can I buy food or medicine or even go to the doctor? This is the world they want to take us to. This is where they want to put us. And it's just, it's amazing to me that evidently we haven't figured this out because it's pretty simple. If they're touting it, it's a screw job. We're going to get the shaft. Simple. Doesn't get any easier than that. And I look at Santorum. He's out there. All he can do is throw bombs. Make accusations that nobody can back up. And especially him. He can't back them up. He was in Idaho, you know, talking to the same group of folks saying, well, you know, the federal government doesn't care about your land. They don't care about this land. They don't live here. We need to get the land back into the hands of the states because they don't care about you and they don't care about this land. We need to get it back into the hands of, here it comes, the private sector. And we can make money doing it. Because everything to them is about how do we get what's we the peoples into the hands of they the profiteers. That's what it's all about. And you hear it time and time and time again. It doesn't get any easier to figure out. They hate anything that is ours. Everything has to be theirs. I think it's pretty simple to see that. You know, some of the great achievements for working people, Medicare and Social Security, that they have handled poorly. If they would pay back the trillions of dollars that they stole during the Reagan and Bush and Clinton years, especially the Reagan years, Social Security would be fine. If we didn't have to pay all of the other costs for health care, and all of the profits and all of that that go into it, our healthcare system would be fine. But we in this country seem to love the idea that we pay full price for prescription drugs. We pay full price, and that's a thing of pride for us because we're dumb. Yes, we pay full price, as it should be. We pay twice as much for healthcare, twice as much as anybody else. That's because we're Americans. And yet we don't get the best outcomes. We don't have the best access. I mean, if you really want to buy their baloney, we should be flipping mad that the insurance premiums are so high and we get so little. Personally, I think we need a single-payer plan. I think we open up Medicare for everybody. Everybody. And then you stop seeing all of the nonsense going on. Oh, let's pick from old people and let's pick from granny and those disabled people. We could take that Medicaid away. Put everybody into the same pool. Everybody for everything. And you pay your taxes and you do it on tax. Or you simply say, this is how much it costs. You're going to pay a premium since we seem to love to pay premiums. So we're going to say it's going to be $300 a month. Everybody has to pay $300 a month. And you know what? If you're at the bottom of the scale and you can't, you know what? We're going to comp it to you because we believe in health as a society, especially prevention, something that the Republicans don't really want to talk about. It's nuts. Jesus. Anyway, Mitt Romney has a new attack ad out. He's going after Tricky Ricky Santorum. It's an ad with Mitzi driving around in a Chrysler 300. He's driving around Detroit, looking at the ruins left behind by the evil union bosses. It was those evil union people who moved those jobs overseas, and it was those evil union people who decided to only make really big cars. It was those evil union people who decided to cash out and pay the investor class. It was those evil people. But there he is driving around in a Chrysler 300, built in Brampton, Ontario. Talking about why he cares about the car companies and American manufacturing and American cars. Driving a Canadian-made car. I guess you could make the argument almost American. The Chrysler 200 is manufactured in the U.S., and I know, what's the difference? 200, 300, who cares? My favorite image in the little 30-second attack ad is of Mitzi and dear old dad. Yeah, there's Mitzi, a young Mitzi with dear old dad at the 1964 World's Fair. Now remember the ads about how much he loves Detroit and how he's a Michigan guy. He's at the 64 World Fair in New York. And he's looking down on the poor people from a helipad way up. And I'm sure he didn't climb up there. I'm sure a helicopter dropped him off. But you know, that's connecting with the little people. Yes, I care, and I look down on you. Oh, man. Anyway, let's take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
I got a picture in my pocket of the lucky one. I'll announce the winner on the radio. With my microphone, I do a super show. I wear a cowboy hat. It is my business hat. I'm on till 1 a.m. I must tell you that I'm a man with a mission.
The Rick Smith Show. Teaching America for the better.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
People often ask us how to see a green flash.
The green flash is an optical phenomenon that you can see shortly after sunset or before sunrise. It happens when the sun is almost entirely below the horizon, with the barest edge of the sun, the upper edge, still visible.
For a second or two, that upper rim of the sun will appear green in color. It's a brief flash of the color green, the legendary green flash. It's really very exciting to see, especially if you've been looking for one. And it's said that once you've seen a green flash, you'll never again go wrong in matters of the heart.
To see a green flash, you need two things. First, a clear day with no haze or clouds near the horizon. Next, you need a distant horizon with a distinct edge. You can see the green flash from a mountaintop or high building, but it's most often seen over the ocean by people on beaches or in boats.
Here's something really important. When you're looking for a green flash, don't look at the sun until it's nearly entirely below the horizon. If you do, you'll dazzle or even damage your eyes. Plus, you'll ruin your green flash chances for that day. For more, come to earthsky.org and search for the words green flash. I'm Deborah Bird.
And I'm Jorge Salazar. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science. We're at earthsky.org.
These are fighting the battles of the 1920s and the 1930s. And when we brought up things like the weekend or child labor laws, it's because things like right to work should be about as old a debate as they are.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can download the podcast there at the website. Or if you've got a smartphone, you can get the Stitcher app and take the program on the go. So it looks like Colorado, who had a no rights at work bill going through, looks like it has, that bill has died in the Senate Business, Labor, and Technology Committee. Again, you know, they just had a vote not too long ago. To push this nonsense that was defeated. So obviously the people of Colorado don't want it, but yet the crazy people, the T-twits, they do. And the moneyed people, they do. And you look at Arizona, and really states across the country going after this no rights at work agenda. It's just, where are the jobs? I thought it was about jobs. How is this going to help any of our jobs? It's not. Anyway, that's why I've asked Sarah Jaffe. She is alternate labor, alternate.com's labor person, here to talk about the Arizona collective bargaining law that is, well, hopefully not going to go through. Sarah, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So tell me, what's going on in Arizona? In Colorado, fortunately, they were able to hold this no rights at work bill back. How's it looking in Arizona?
Well, Arizona had a whole bunch of bills that our buddy Jan Brewer and some of the creepier guys in the state Senate were pushing. And it looks like the worst of them, which was the one that would completely eliminate collective bargaining for public employees, doesn't have the votes even with the Republicans in the state Senate. That's TPM is reporting that based on some Arizona papers that are reporting it, that the state senators are basically saying that not even Republicans are willing to vote to completely eliminate collective bargaining. And one of the things with this bill is that it included police and firefighters, which, you know, Scott Walker notoriously didn't, and Ohio notoriously did. And that's probably one of the reasons that even Republicans are a little nervous about it.
Yeah, I mean, I've got a friend who is a Republican, and he's a firefighter in Arizona.
Right.
And, you know, he's an elected official, and you don't really want to screw around with the police and fire. That's one of the things I think Walker, I think that's one of the things Walker did right. If you can give him credit for anything, the scumbag that he is. But it's one of the things he did right, because the public generally on the side of cops and firemen.
Yeah, I mean, although Walker, you know, the cops and the firemen, or at least some of the cops and all of the firemen in Wisconsin decided that they were not, you know, they weren't going to side against their the other workers.
Well, they understood that they're in the fishbowl, too. I mean,
yep,
when the shark's coming around, it's whatever's left. And if you're you're in the shark tank, eventually it's your turn.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think Arizona probably, you know, the Republicans who are smart enough to not vote for this thing realized that they didn't want that big, messy protest. Meanwhile, they're going to sneak through some other things that are also pretty nasty.
So let me ask you this. I mean, why? I mean, Arizona's already one of these right-to-work states. What more can you possibly take from these people? Are you going to criminalize
them? Yeah, I mean, these bills are coming out of a think tank, right? A lot of them are coming out of ALEC, but these ones in Arizona were pushed by the Goldwater Institute, which is, everybody remembers Barry Goldwater best for famously really losing the presidency by a lot.
Right.
And actually, thinking back on Goldwater, he sort of reminds me of Ron Paul, but anyway. And so they're pushing these bills because this is their agenda, right? This is what they do. They get paid to sit around and crank out legislation that's going to beat up on workers. Because that's their agenda, and they push it through, and they get, it's the same thing with a lot of these things that we've seen pop up around the country, right? They're cranked out by people whose job it is to crank out this legislation. They're fed to right-wing legislators who are connected into this, whether, you know, locally in Arizona with the Goldwater Institute or nationally with things like ALEC. They're pumping out these model bills that people then take and tweak a little bit, but basically use. And we don't have anything like that on our side.
Yeah, you know, I remember Florida. There was a woman in Florida who actually used one of the ALEC legislation, pieces of legislation, and didn't bother to take ALEC out of the legislation.
Yep, exactly. I mean, we just don't. I mean, imagine if the AFL was funding model legislation around the country. Can you imagine the freakouts from Fox News?
Yeah, I'm kind of hoping that happens so that we can see their heads explode literally and not just figuratively.
This is true.
Because they would. I mean, they would go absolutely ballistic.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
But we seem to think there are people that think, well, you know, it's just they're helping. And this is my main argument against term limits. I think we already have term limits. You vote people out or doing bad jobs. What ends up happening is you end up giving more power to these groups who, you know, have to give money to these people to get elected.
Yeah.
It's really a very incestuous relationship. And you look at the Walkers and you look at Jan Brewer in Arizona. They're all funded by the same, by the billionaire class, the same people who are funding these think tanks to push this stuff through. So I guess, is it really any surprise?
Yeah, well, Jan Brewer's pet cause, actually one of the reasons that they're saying the collective bargaining bill is likely to fail is that she doesn't really care about that one as much. She wants another one that she complained to an ALEC meeting, actually, about how she wants it to be easier for her to fire public employees. So what she's pushing is a proposal that would give public employees in Arizona their first raise in several years in exchange for them basically giving up all of their job security. They would become at-will employees. So, you know, it sounds good for a second, right? Oh, we're going to get our first raise in 5 years. But in actual fact, she can decide that she wants to lay off, you know, 20 people tomorrow, and you're out of a job, and your raise that you got for 2 weeks really isn't helping.
And, you know,
and the workers certainly aren't buying that.
Well, I mean, the great thing about that is it takes us right back to the days of patronage.
Right.
So people who work on her campaigns and people who give her money, those public sector jobs can be doled out as, well, thank you for that donation. We'll give your grandchild one of your kids a job, or thank you for that work. We're going to give you a job there. Hey, that sounds like good party politic.
Yeah, and when you look at these people who are pushing these, you know, they want to get rid of job security, there also seem to be the same ones who are really putting all their buddies in political positions. You look at my good friend Nikki Haley, South Carolina governor, who already has, you know, one of the lowest union densities in the country, and she wants to make it worse. And meanwhile, she's getting investigative stories written left and right about the way that she's putting people in high-paid positions. She's creating new positions. I was looking at her budget last week for another story and just looking at the, you know, the places where payroll is increasing as opposed to the places where payroll is being cut. We know who's being cut, right?
Yep.
Teachers.
Absolutely. Cops, firemen, all of them. All the public sector workers, the garbage men down.
Yeah, well, today one of the things they're floating to deal with a payroll tax cut is a cut for federal workers' wages.
Yeah, well,
so the federal workers
board.
Get, you know, a permanent wage decrease. It's going to drive their wages down forever, and the rest of us get a temporary tax cut.
And I never understood how cut, gut, and punish is going to help grow our economy. And I look all of this, and a lot of this is, well, yeah, I agree, but a lot of this is just a distraction. The fact of the matter is I think they have not a clue of, one, how to govern, but two, how to create an economy that's going to work for at least for us anyway. All they know is cut, gut, and punish.
Well, you know, Thomas Frank calls them the wrecking crew for a reason. You know, you get people who ideologically think that government is too big in government, and they, you know, people who don't have any respect for the idea or the institution of government, and particularly for its service-providing capacities, like things like teachers and firefighters, once again, they don't care about that. They're ideologically opposed to it. So, of course, they run it badly.
Well, it drives me nuts.
But then that, you know, that also plays into the same old thing, which is they run the schools badly, they defund the teachers, they defund everything, and then they start winding on the campaign trail. Oh, all the public schools are terrible. We're going to give you vouchers to get your kids out of the public schools because public schools are so terrible. Public schools are terrible because they made them terrible.
Yeah, but what it says to me is that we're too stupid to realize that we're voting for people who hate government. They hate what they're doing, and yet when they come back to us and say, see, it failed, we go, well, you don't like doing it. You don't believe in it. Of course it failed.
Right. Exactly.
Just nuts. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're here with Sarah Jaffe. She is the labor person over at alternet.org. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Sarah's name. The other part of this, not only, you know, the attack on workers' rights, this attack on public sector workers. You know, the right-wing nut jobs are just... you know, they got their talking points, and it's full force ahead.
Yeah, we ran a lovely piece last week, actually, at Alternate Labor by a writer called Melissa Chadburn, who is from California, and she sat down with a couple of public sector workers and talked to them about how it feels to be constantly demonized in the press and what that then turns around and what that does to them at work, both for morale and the actual policies that get enacted on them because they become the scapegoat for everything.
Yeah, I was talking with my daughter's teacher the other day. It was parent-teacher conference. And he's like, you know, all of this, the standardized test, all of this stuff is just, well, it's. He says he wants to get out.
Yeah, not surprised.
Not a good thing at all. Sarah, always great talking with you. I appreciate the time.
Thanks for having me.
Alternet.org, the website. Go to the labor page. Sarah Jaffe's articles are fantastic. Quick break, right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Listening to The Rick Smith Show.
It is believed that a little hard work is good for the soul. If this is true, then the history of child workers in the United States is a soulful tale. The first child laborers landed in Virginia in the year 1619. These immigrant children found slave working conditions and poverty wages in their new world. As the years passed, little changed. The average child worker toiled 16 to 18 hours per day, 6 days a week in factories and textile mills. Education was a luxury, and many believed a loss on working children. Charles Harding, president of the Merchants Woolen Company, stated, "There is such a thing as too much education for working people sometimes. I have seen cases where young people are spoiled for labor by too much refinement." Labor unions, consumer groups, and parent coalitions all work to shorten hours, ease conditions, and ultimately end exploitative child abuses. Baby strikes in Paterson, New Jersey, and Allentown, Pennsylvania, demanding 11 and 12-hour workdays, were fought vehemently by mill and factory owners. The Pennsylvania legislature was the first to consider prohibiting child workers in 1833, and
consider is all Pennsylvania did until July of 1903, when Mother Jones led the March of the Mill Children from Philadelphia to Oyster Bay, New York, in an attempt to influence President Theodore Roosevelt. In 1836, Massachusetts was the first state to pass a law restricting the use of children in manufacturing. And 102 years later, the United States Supreme Court ruled the Walsh-Healy Act restricting the use of child labor as constitutional. Also in 1938, Congress passed the Fair Labor Standards Act, which put more stringent restrictions on the use of child labor. While hard work teaches discipline, self-reliance, and responsibility, the exploitive nature of our past must remind us that what we have today, we mustn't take for granted, for the days of tomorrow are doomed to repeat if we ignore those lessons hard learned. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
You can't tell me we're gonna make it somehow. I heard a wise man say revolution starts now. I think it's time for change.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, Rick at therickSmithShow.com. So I'm looking at the New York Times article, and it's talking about foreclosures. Out evidently in San Francisco, they did an audit. The county officials out there grabbed about 400 recent foreclosures, and they went through and said, well, let's take a look at these. Are they legit? Well, it turns out that almost all of them, all of the 400 that they sampled, had some legal violation or suspicious documentation problem. Now, what they're saying is going, well, you know, we went through this and they're cheating, they're lying, they're thieving, no good sons of guns. No, they're not saying that, but they are. What they're saying is, you know, the evidence has indicated the foreclosure abuse has been plentiful, but, you know, now they have something in hand. The improprieties range from the basic failure to warn borrowers that they were in default. So basically telling people, hey, you know, you're in default, which is required by law, to, you know, not having the right paperwork at all. Many of the loans in foreclosures were made by entities that had no right to assign them, and institutions took back properties in auctions even though they had not proven ownership. And I go back to what Marcy Kaptur said. You know, before you let them throw you out of your house, make them show you the documentation. Show you the note. Make them show that they own it. And we're seeing time and time again, look what's going on. They're kicking people to the curb who shouldn't have been. And I see this story that Reuters had, that Citigroup agreed to pay $158.3 million to settle civil claims that they defrauded the government in some of their mortgage dealings. So they paid $158.3 million to resolve these claims under the False Claims Act. Evidently, a whistleblower came forward and said, you know what, they're screwing you, government. So they went after it, and Citigroup admitted in the document to accept responsibility. They admit, acknowledge, and accept responsibility for misleading the government into insuring risky home loans, according to their settlement papers. The misconduct, 6 years in the making. Took 6 years. They were doing it for 6 years. Now, the whistleblower might get up to 25% of the settlement, which would be a nice chunk of change for her. Good luck on that. Citigroup spokesperson Mark Rogers, he said that the bank was... they were pleased to settle. They were pleased. Claims brought under the False Claims Act have recovered some $34 billion in federal and state cases since the law was enacted, amended in 86, according to the Taxpayers Against Fraud Education Fund. Now, here's the thing. They go through, the government said that Citigroup falsely certified many of the loans that they had, and said that they qualified for insurance under the Federal Housing Agency, part of HUD. Investigators said 9,600 or more than 30% of the nearly 30,000 HUD-insured mortgages that City Mortgage had have defaulted. And it's, get this, it costed the agency nearly $200 million in emergency claims. Stop and think about this for a second. Maybe I'm the dumb one. It cost us $200 million in insurance claims. Citi has agreed to pay $158.3 million. If I could get that kind of a setup, I would be happy to settle too. I would be pleased as punch to be able to settle that. Because they broke the law. They said they broke the law. They said they were screwing us. They admitted it and said, yes, we did, and we will pay. And we're going to give them $41.7 million? Does that make any sense to anybody? I mean, at the minimum, you say it costs us $200 million. At the minimum, it's going to cost you $200 million. We want our money back. You know, I hear Romney saying, oh, I'll take on the union bosses. Is he going to take on the CEOs? Can we get somebody who's going to go after these people and hold them accountable? If I stole a 50-cent pack of gum from the local store, do you think they'd say, oh, just give us 40 cents back and we'll call it even? No. They're going to lock me up, throw away the key. So the question I have is, you know, will Romney stand up to them? If it's going to be President Romney, is he going to stand up to them? The answer is no. Of course not. Listen to his idea on what we do with the mortgage crisis. You know, this idea that, well, you know, we just let bottom out.
As to what to do for the housing industry specifically, and are there things that you can do to encourage housing? One is don't try and stop the foreclosure process. Let it run its course and hit the bottom, allow investors to buy homes, put renters in them, fix the homes up, and let it turn around and come back up.
Yes. Screw all those people. That's their mentality. So I'm reading this article in Reuters today. And they're talking about Santa Monica Boulevard. Evidently, Beverly Hills mansions are not immune to being foreclosed on. And it goes through all of these mansions who people have just walked away from. Multi-million dollar mortgages. The one mansion that they were talking about, this sprawling Spanish-style estate, fringed with majestic pine trees, located near the boutiques on Santa Monica Boulevard. The former owners were served default notices. They were, $205,000 behind on payments in their mortgages. Over $200,000 behind. The mortgage was $6.9 million. And as I'm reading through the article, the people are quite, as a matter of fact, look, this isn't emotional for these people. This is a business decision. They have the money to be able to pay. The people who were in this estate, they had the ability to pay. They just decided, well, you know what? My house isn't worth $6.9 million anymore. It's probably worth $3 million. I'm not paying for it. I'm going to leave. With no emotional attachment whatsoever. And I think, you know, as I'm sitting, I'm thinking about this. I'm thinking about the Romneys of the world. Who really, when he says, we'll let it collapse, all those people at the bottom, they'll lose that house. And investors will come in and they'll buy it up. And it's, you know, it's a very sterile transaction. What that tells me is he has no clue what that house meant to that person who lost it at the bottom. Because to him, a house is just a place, it's a liability. Because he knows he's going to be able to have somewhere to put his head at the end of the day. Because he's a rich dude. And the more I think about this, the more I say, you know, there are really two Americas. They're the ones that, there's the America that Mitt Romney and his clan live in. And then there's the rest of us who, you know, our home is our castle. Our home is everything. And I got to be honest, I don't know what I would do if I lost my home and my children and my wife and I were out in the street. Don't know what you would do. But to these folks, well, they've got choices. And the choice is, well, we're just not going to pay. Yet if, bet your last dollar on this, if the Romneys of the world or the Limbaughs or the Becks or any of those people of the world ever found a working person who said, you know what, I'm making $50,000 a year. The house is just, you know, I tried. I'm going to just let it go and try and find something cheaper. They would skewer them. And to me, it's this idea that somehow they're superior. And I listen to Santorum walking around saying, oh, it's elitist snobbery that we want to send kids to college. It's elitist snobbery that we should be helping people. I'm really concerned about the direction of the message. Especially when you look at the whole foreclosure thing. You know, had we done what I wanted to do right from the very beginning, which was have the government buy up all those loans, take the haircut right at the beginning. Say, you know what, the big banks, you're taking a haircut. We're going to take those mortgages off your back. We're going to administer them. We're going to try and keep people in their homes. Because you know what? It's better for neighborhoods. It's good, better for property value. It's better for everybody if we keep people put. See, but the Romneys of the world, they see bust as an opportunity. They see crisis. They see chaos as an opportunity to profit. Because his first thought is, well, you know, we'll just buy those up. We'll put renters in them. You know, put those people who used to own the house, put them back in there. Let them pay rent. And then they can pay me. And it's really a very different mentality. And, you know, they went through story after story of these people who just said, you know, we're going to leave. They call it a strategic default. I guess it's so frequent that they now have a term for it, where rich people just say, you know what? House isn't worth it. The investment isn't worth it anymore. We're moving on. And I guess that's another dividing line between the elite snobs, if you will, as Santorum loves to point out, there are elite snobs. I would say that's a good dividing line to find who the elite snob is. The person who says, well, you know what, I'm just going to walk away from the house. I have no emotional attachment to it whatsoever. It's not part of my family. It's not what I've worked my entire life for. No, it's just a thing. It's because I think the home, especially when you look at the housing bubble, people were sold this idea that the American dream is tied to having that home and having a place for your children and having a place that you call your own. The Romneys of the world and the billionaires, they don't see it that way. They've got more houses than they know what to do with. Remember the 2008 McCain? What, do you have 7, 8, 10 houses? Didn't know which ones were where or what the addresses were, probably. Two Americas. And you got Romney running around saying, well, you know, I'm like you. No, you're not. You're never going to be like me. You're never going to understand. Never going to understand what it's like. And this foreclosure thing. If we follow that, and there's part of me says maybe we should follow that. Maybe we should follow that plan. Because what it may end up doing for us is it may end up getting people off their behinds and going, well, we need to fight back. It might get people enraged, which I think has to at some point happen, especially over this foreclosure mess. Because, you know, the settlement, I'm not thrilled with it. I don't know that it's quite big enough. But again, what we've done, and nicely, mind you, is we have given the people who committed the crime, we've let them off and given them some going away money. I look at this city thing. It's mind-blowing to me. You're going to fine them the settlement's $158 million, but it cost us $200 million, and nobody's going to jail? I want people locked up. 6 years they committed fraud against the government. Nobody's going to get locked up? Just nuts. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
This is WFTE 90.3 FM Mount Cobb and W289 AU 105.7 FM Scranton, Pennsylvania. Listen to us throughout Northeast Pennsylvania or check us out on the web at WFTE.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. A new poll from United Technologies National Journal Congressional Connection shows strong opposition to making any cuts at all to Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. The poll also shows strong support among the American people for cutting the military budget. 76% of Americans say no cuts at all to Social Security. 80% say no cuts at all to Medicare. When it comes to military spending, 60% support some or a lot of cuts. Teamsters members at Hostess have overwhelmingly authorized a strike if Hostess is granted its court action to impose unfair contract terms as part of the bankruptcy process. Companies often use bankruptcy proceedings to destroy union contracts for workers while making sure that CEOs and other executives keep lavish compensation packages. The more than 7,500 Teamsters at Hostess have twice before made sacrifices to help the company. But the union says worker sacrifices need to be matched by sacrifices from other key stakeholders in the company. A hearing on the court action is set for March 5th. Florida corrections officers are praising the state Senate there for voting down a proposal to privatize more than two dozen prisons. The privatization proposal would have put thousands of Florida Department of Corrections employees out of work, according to the union representing corrections workers. Hundreds of corrections workers traveled to Florida's capital to urge lawmakers to kill the privatization bill. Ken Wood of Teamsters Local 2011 says his 20,000 corrections officers members are grateful that a bipartisan Senate majority voted against privatizing those prisons. Police unions in New York City are demanding that the city release data on the cancer rate among police who responded at Ground Zero right after the September 11th attacks. They want the data to get cancer added to the list of diseases covered by the federal Zadroga Act. The law compensates Ground Zero first responders for related health issues but omits cancer. New York's Patrolmen's Benevolent Association says it has young men and women members dying from cancer at unusual rates for their ages, and it's unconscionable that the city won't release the data. A 1,000-mile trip is being planned for workers who have been locked out of both Cooper Tire and American Sugar plants. The trip starts in Fargo, North Dakota, where beet sugar workers were locked out 6 months ago. The Cooper Tire workers were locked out in late November. The workers will make stops in Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Indiana before ending the trip in Findlay, Ohio. Locking out workers during contract negotiations is becoming a common problem for American workers. Caterpillar, HealthBridge, and Manitowoc Crane have all locked out their employees in recent months. The CEO of American Sugar said in a secretly recorded meeting with shareholders that the lockout was part of a greater plan to break the back of the union. This newscast was made possible in part through underwriting support from the hardworking men and women of the IBEW, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
There is no America. There is no democracy. There is only IBM and ITT and AT&T and DuPont, Dow, Union Carbide, and Exxon. Those are the nations of the world today.
Yeah, those are the nations, and they shouldn't have to pay any taxes. That seems to be the mantra. Anyway, welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, rick@therickSmithShow.com, or give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. If you missed any portion of the program, you can download the podcast at the website, or if you've got a smartphone, get the Stitcher app, and you can take the program on the go. Got an email during the break reminding me that I did not mention Susan B. Anthony's 192nd birthday yesterday. So a reminder is near. She is attributed to saying some very interesting things. Seems like women today should be saying the same kind of things. She said, "I distrust those people who know so well what God wants them to do, because I notice it always coincides with their own desires." Gee, does that sound familiar? I mean, you listen to all of these right-wing evangelicals. Boy, it sounds really, really very self-serving. You know, God wants you to be rich. Send me $5. Nuts. She goes, also said, no self-respecting woman should wish or work for the success of a party that ignores her sex. And that particularly, in this day and age, especially right now with all the discussion going on about women's issues, that should be one that I'm hoping any woman who would vote for a Republican would stop and think about. No self-respecting woman should wish or work for the success of a party that ignores her sex. Uh, 192nd birthday. You're talking about probably something she said 170 years ago. Is it not amazing how history continues to repeat itself? And on this day, the 95th anniversary of Emma Goldman getting arrested in New York City for doing what? Lecturing about birth control. My head's about to explode. One of the quotes I found from her, women need not always keep their mouths shut and their wombs open. Hello, women? Yeah? You think about that one just a little bit? Understand, these people, they're just nuts. And I look at this hearing today where, the female Democrats got up and walked out. Why'd you even bother going? I mean, you're talking about an all male panel of witnesses. They had one from the Catholic Church, the Lutheran Church. They had a Jewish rabbi, had a Southern Baptist, ethics professor. Had a whole bunch of people who, a whole bunch of men who, really, that's going to decide women's health? Now, understand, there has been Obama backed up. He said, okay, the Catholic Church, they don't have to pay for contraceptions. But the health insurance companies are going to have to. Seems like a rational compromise. That's not enough, because they want to go all the way back to the good old days where you arrest people for talking about birth control. They arrested people. That's where they want to take us. And I've been saying this for the longest time. They want to go back before Griswold. They want to go back to the day where if you mention a condom, they lock you up. If you mention, oh, gee, as a woman, I don't want to have 1,600 children, they lock you up. And it's just, it's kind of ironic, and it's kind of, when you look at history, history has a kind of way of smacking the upside the head. 95th anniversary today. And today's the day that they have this kangaroo hearing where a bunch of guys are saying, well, I don't think the church should have to guarantee that women have anything. And the other day you had McConnell saying, well, I don't think an employer should have to provide insurance for anybody that they have a moral conscience not to provide. Where does that lead us? That leads us straight down, straight back to the days of, I'm not even going to say slavery, because I don't think they want to go back to slavery. I think they learned that, we don't need slaves. We can just, we can let them fend for themselves. And I love what Bill Maher said the other night. He said, Santorum believes that life begins at erection. And I've been saying that. Wait for that to happen next, guys. It's coming. And you wonder, why? You wonder why? You wonder why the Republicans have such a low enthusiasm. Why these candidates are getting such low turnout. And I think about Santorum's guy, Foster Freeze, who was interviewed today about this. And listen, you're going to love this. Listen to this.
Now, let me ask you this question.
This one.
Do you have any concerns about some of his comments on social issues, on contraception, on women in combat, and whether or not that would hurt his viability in a general election campaign? Would he be the nominee?
Well, I get such a chuckle when these things come out. Here we have millions of our fellow Americans unemployed. We have jihadist camps being set up in Latin America, which Rick has been warning about, and people seem to be so preoccupied with sex. I think it says something about our culture. We maybe need a massive therapy session so we can concentrate on what the real issues are. And this contraceptive thing, my gosh, it's such inexpensive. Back in my days, they used bare aspirin for contraceptives. The gals put it between their knees, and it wasn't that costly.
Excuse me, I'm just trying to catch my breath from that, Mr. Freeze, frankly.
And you know what's sad about that? She had to call him Mr. Freeze. I mean, it's one of those things where, he's completely out of line, and she still feels the need that she has to. I would have told him, but that's the right-wing patriarchal mentality. And he is right on one vein. Why are we talking about this? We should be talking about jobs. The reason we're talking about this is the radical right wing in this country is pursuing this full guns blazing. Why? It's a cover for the fact that they haven't done anything to create jobs in this country. That's what it's about. And it's insane. And I listened to this other guy, and I got to play this clip too. You'll love this. One of these right-wing internet radio guys from the American Family group, just one of these groups that they're nuts. Listen to this. You'll love this.
Now, let me ask you this question. If our national security is on the line, the defense of your children, your family, your grandchildren, when that's on the line, who do you want manning the howitzers? Who do you want manning the M-16s? Who do you want manning the fighter planes? Do you want somebody who is characterized by sensitivity, warmth, and apprehension? That is somebody who's sensitive, who is warm, and who is easily spooked? Is that who you want defending your national security? Or do you want somebody who is characterized by emotional stability, dominance, rule, consciousness, and vigilance? Well, if your answer is B, which I think any objective, logical, right-thinking, clear-headed, non-politically correct, corrupted thinking person would think, clearly you have just said we ought to have men in combat. They are wired for it by personnel. It's part of their DNA. Women are not wired either by evolution or by God, whoever's responsible for this difference. They are not.
They're just not wired
by DNA and innate personality characteristics to be in those positions.
And there are women voting for these people. That's the scary thing. I mean, I just listen to their words. They're insane. It's, well, it is what it is. Anyway, let's go to the phone lines. What do you got to say today, Andy?
Hi, Rick. How you doing?
I'm just scratching my head. You know, it's one of those things where you go, really? Is this, you know, 100 years, 200 years of progress, and it looks like we're going backwards?
Yeah, I had to call about that mortgage deal that was done on the 9th, the $26 billion to, I've seen as high as $40 billion, impossible settlement with the five banks, but you had that clip with Foster Freeze. I just couldn't get over that. What a thing to say to a woman reporter about the aspirin between his legs, putting aspirin between your legs. I mean, what a awful. I mean, he's so, was totally disrespectful to all women by just brushing the act of, getting pregnant and getting in that position where you have an unwanted pregnancy and just totally playing it down as just, a matter of getting aspirin.
Yeah, and a man had nothing to do with it. Had nothing to do with it.
Right, and this guy, you have to know, this guy is a real, real religious nutcase.
Absolutely.
He is a strong Christian, and that's why he buys Centaurum. And he basically has said right off the bat category, this is an investment. He is making an investment in the future with Rick Santorum. So he owns a president. Like he would own a Senate. Like when Rick Santorum was in the Senate, he was owned by the health insurance companies and corporate America and the defense contractors in Pennsylvania. He's going to be owned by Foster Freeze.
Yep. And that's what Citizens United has done to this country.
Right. It's brought back us, and it has, and you've said this many times, it's brought us back to the 18th, the 19th century. And Louis Brandeis said it best. You know, either we can create great wealth in this country or we can have a democracy, but we can't have both.
Yep.
And the decision has been made, we have great wealth. And yeah, we've gotten to the point where it is overwhelmingly, and it's unteenable. It's not a country anymore close to being representative of its people. It's not even close.
Yeah.
It only represents the top, and that's it. But anyway, talk about that mortgage deal where I want to vent. This was a crime. You know, homeowners, they say, are underwater right now, $700 billion to $1 trillion, meaning that their mortgage does not cover the value of the home when you get the bank. That's how much underwater they are. And here you have, you know, a $26 billion deal, and only $17 billion is going to reduce principal for 1 million homeowners when there are 11 million homeowners underwater.
Yep.
So So what does it help? Help 2% of all homeowners or something like that? I mean, it's just insane. And the banks, these five banks, got bailed out to the tune of $14 trillion by both the Fed and the Treasury. And we had the FOIA request from Bloomberg News, who showed that the Fed did indeed give out $7 trillion on its own to bail these banks out. When they were saying everything was fine, we're well capitalized, we can make things work, they had hundreds of billions of dollars in their capital that was being supplied by the Fed and the Treasury, or else they go under. And we didn't know that at the time. We only knew about this $700 billion TARP diversion, when really the Fed and Treasury were just lopping out money and printing money like a printing press that could have caused great inflation and great harm to our nation. And here they are settling.
Yeah, and for peanuts. Also, and for peanuts. I mean, that's the thing that gets
peanuts.
Me.
Yeah, they took $14 trillion and they're settling for $26 billion? Come on. And the $1 trillion at the max of the homeowners that are underwater caused by them because of their illegal use of the securitization of mortgages that went on, you know, the total poor ratings and sales of fraudulent, Carl Levin, you know, said what the deals were. I can't say it on the air, but you know what these deals were.
Yep.
They were total garbage.
Absolutely.
It was fraud, complete fraud, and done by the banksters. And then $2,000 per home over that got foreclosed on by a robocall. What does that pay, 1 month's rent? What insanity is that? We should be nationalizing these banks and taking everything they have, and the CEOs and all the executives should be getting paid like $100,000 a year, and all the rest of that money should be going to the homeowners that got robocalled and their houses taken away. They should be getting thousands of dollars to buy their homes back.
Well, as I said
not
from the beginning,
$2,000,
we should have nationalized it. We should have nationalized the bank, broken them up into smaller regional state banks, bring back the state banking commissions, put erect borders again. And
the MERS system has to go, this electronic
absolutely.
Documentation system for the title and the documents on all the homes. That's got to go, too. That's got to be brought back to the local level where it used to be, and on paper and done by your local municipalities, not by an electronic system housed in Washington run by the banksters themselves.
Yeah, because you pay for it. I mean, every time you buy or sell a house, you're paying for title insurance. So you're telling me that the whole system's that screwed up and I'm paying for something I'm not getting? That's more, in my opinion, more fraud.
That's right. That should be done at the local level the way it used to be and kept by the municipalities, the deeds of trust and whatnot and the title, like you said, and all the liens and everything else. That should be all done at the local, not by some fraudsters and by some company paid by the American bankers. Again, another fraudulent type of institution, just like the credit agencies are, when you have issuer-based payment and you have customer-based. I mean, the institution that needs to abuse this institution the most is paying for that service. That's dead wrong. That's got to be split apart, just like when you pay for a credit rating on a mortgage-backed security. Goldman Sachs is paying for the credit rating. So, of course, they're going to get a high rating, and they're not going to get the credit rating agency is not going to get the business. This is total corruption.
Yep.
The whole model, the whole way the financial structure is set up has got to be changed. And the MERS system is one place that change has to be made. But stop doing this electronic centralized system just for the benefit of the banksters and going against everything for a homeowner.
I'm right there with you. Right there with you, Andy.
I just wanted to vent on that, Rick.
I appreciate the venting. It's well needed.
All right.
Thanks
so
much.
Great show.
Thanks. I appreciate
it. Great
work. Let's take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Where do you fit in? Take a look at yourself. 10% of the people.
Where smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
In my state of Texas, things tend to be bigger. Bigger hats, bigger money, and bigger thievery by political con men. Last year, the gang of GOP hucksters who controlled our state government pulled off a huge heist, covering it up with an equally huge boast. We balanced our budget, not by raising taxes, but by cutting government spending, bragged the gang leader, Governor Rick Perry. How'd they fill the $27 billion shortfall that they themselves had created by their previous budgetary mismanagement? By stealing money from already poorly funded programs, from education to parks, that ordinary Texans count on. People here are justly proud of their 94 parks, but many are now understaffed, open fewer hours, and in disrepair, because the Perryites whacked the system's budget by 21.5%. But that was only part of the robbery. A state sales tax on sporting goods, dedicated by law to help finance the people's parks, will generate about $236 million this year and next. But the governor and his legislative henchmen also raided this pile of revenue, filching two-thirds of it for the state's general fund so they could claim that they balanced our budget without raising taxes. To replenish some of the money taken by the Perry gang, the great state of Texas is now engaged in a shocking spectacle, public begging. In a video played at 11 December press conferences in state parks across Texas, the chief of our parks department is reduced to shaking a tin cup, pleading for $4.6 million in donations. Please act now to help keep our state parks open for all Texans to enjoy, he beseeches. This is Jim Hightower saying, how pathetic. Right-wing politicians across our country howl that they want to shrink government, but they are the shrunken ones, and the narrowness of their vision is diminishing what it means to be American.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
The proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
Rick, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Got an email during the break. Jim writes, don't these people have anything else to worry about? Are they so sexually obsessed or just plain sick? As far as women are concerned, look at the Russian battalions feared most in many countries. I look at this guy, this Brian Fisher, and this guy scares me because under the guise of religion, he's out there saying some really just nonsensical things. You know, if you listen to this rant, I struggle sometimes with this mentality that the right wing has, especially the people who call themselves these super Christians, like this guy, this Brian Fisher, the American Family Association. And I guess it's part of me that thinks it's a very patriarchal thing that, you know, the man is the head of the house, and this world view that women should be subservient. And I think I've said before, I could live in that country. I could live in that world as a man that, you know, women should bow to my needs and my demands, and I should be able to have the final say and all of those things. But as I've said in the past, you know, my two daughters, I don't want them living in that world. So when I hear someone like Brian Fisher going, well, do you want someone who's characterized by sensitivity, warmth, and apprehension? Somebody who's spooked easily? I'm going, I know some women who, to be honest, I mean, if you're, who'd probably whip his behind. And I know some women who aren't very sensitive, and I know some that aren't very warm or apprehensive. I know some men that are. Here again, this generalization, kind of scary. And this idea that women are wired differently than men, I don't know. There was part of me at one point that may have agreed with you, but some women that I've met recently who are very much war hawks, very much in the idea of wanting to blow things up and kill people, I'm not so sure. But what's interesting to me is that someone like him, someone, you know, like ICE's panel of all men, they're the ones making those choices. You go back to Grassley. Yesterday I talked about it. He's holding the Violence Against Women Act, holding that up. Evidently not happy about gay people or immigrants. And I go back to, you wonder why there's such a low enthusiasm for these Republican candidates. I'm hoping they continue doing the insanity that they're doing. I hope they keep doing all the dumb stuff because, you know, as screwed up as this Foster Freeze's statement was, he is right about one thing. Why are we talking about all this nonsense? Why is it every state has got some kind of weird anti-abortion bill coming up? Why is it almost every state in the country's got some attack on working people? Why is it every state's got some kind of anti-gay language just about? Why is it we're going through the contraception argument? He's right. We should be talking about jobs. We should be talking about securing the country. We should be talking about a whole heck of a lot of other things that we're not. And this is what the Republicans do masterfully. They control the message. They control the public dialogue. They control what's being talked about because they've got this massive mobilized machine well funded by the billionaire class. And that money trickles down from them to all of these little think tanks, all these different organizations, both on the state and national level. And they're always in the ear of legislators, and they're always out there pushing the churches. I mean, they've really co-opted. I mean, the religious right, you have to give them credit. They have really organized some of the church community fairly well. And they couch it in terms of, we're under attack. We're the minority, yet they control what's going on. They're the ones who own the corporations. They're the ones who own the mass media. They're the ones who own the radio stations, the television stations. They're the ones. You know, here on the program, we've been trying to reach out to stations across the state and across the area. Everyone, we're formatted. Or, we've got programming. And it's all right-wing drivel. It's all the same stuff. Because they own it. It's theirs. There's no public airwaves, this nonsense that they're their public airwaves. They're not. They're owned by the billionaire class. And occasionally you get a small voice that comes out of the crowd to have a small chance of saying something. But for the most part, the big microphones, they're controlled by the mega rich. And you look at what's going on with Glenn Beck. I mean, he's going down. His numbers are actually going down. Why? Because he's gotten too crazy for the moneyed interest. They're afraid that he's gone off the deep end, and they don't want people going off the deep end. I mean, he's as long as he was talking the anti-government stuff and destroy government and hate workers and hate unions, he was okay. Now he's gotten into some weird religion rant that's just, wow. I think Father Coughlin would blush at. And the reality in all of this is, until we can organize, until we can come together and we can stand together and fight back, they're going to continue to divide us. They're going to continue to use their think tanks and use their message machines to keep pounding in our head that, oh, the stimulus failed. Didn't you know the stimulus failed? Well, the jobs being created, we stopped the massive losses, things are going in the right direction. Even one of the Republican congressmen in the one hearing said, well, things are going in the right direction. Must have missed the memo on that. But it's all about the messaging. And as long as they control the airwaves, they're going to control the message. As long as they can be constantly in our ear saying, you know what? Obama's bad. Democrats bad. Taxing wealthy people, bad. Bailing out the banks, well, not bad. Good. Help the bankers. See, they were punished. They got a little something. They got a slap on the wrist. And that's all it was. It was a slap on the wrist. And all of the diversion and all of the things to get us all lathered up and all wadded up in the panties. It's all a diversion. It's the shiny thing in the room. You know, bread and circus. Only today it's American Idol and Cheetos or some other nastiness. Keep people mildly fed, mildly entertained, and they won't rise up. They won't take to the streets. But you look at what's going on. November of this year, if we have a President Romney and we have a Republican or we have a President Santorum, may the God that they invoke help us, because we are in a world of trouble. Let's take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
The Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
People often ask us how to see a green flash.
The green flash is an optical phenomenon that you can see shortly after sunset or before sunrise. It happens when the sun is almost entirely below the horizon, with the barest edge of the sun, the upper edge, still visible.
For a second or two, that upper rim of the sun will appear green in color. It's a brief flash of the color green, the legendary green flash. It's really very exciting to see, especially if you've been looking for one. And it's said that once you've seen a green flash, you'll never again go wrong in matters of the heart.
To see a green flash, you need two things. First, a clear day with no haze or clouds near the horizon. Next, you need a distant horizon with a distinct edge. You can see the green flash from a mountaintop or high building, but it's most often seen over the ocean by people on beaches or in boats.
Here's something really important. When you're looking for a green flash, don't look at the sun until it's nearly entirely below the horizon. If you do, you'll dazzle or even damage your eyes. Plus, you'll ruin your green flash chances for that day. For more, come to earthsky.org and search for the words green flash. I'm Deborah Bird.
And I'm Jorge Salazar. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science. We're at earthsky.org.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show. What they do, they smile in your face. All the time you want to take your place, the backstabbers.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Now, to find out what's going on in Washington, D.C. and around the world, Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Victoria, thanks for taking time for me.
Thank you very much.
So the big news of the day, Bayer aspirin. Let me ask you, is Bayer aspirin your chosen birth control method?
Well, that's a remarkably personal question, but it actually never would have been, no.
No, wouldn't have worked. I'm amazed that, you know, I've watched that video a couple of times where Foster Freeze, the guy who owns Santorum, laid that out, and the woman who was there on camera kind of just stops, and then, well, okay, Mr. Freeze, I'm still stuck with the whole Mr. Freeze thing.
Yeah, no, it's Andrea Mitchell, who's a very experienced journalist, and she says, "Excuse me, I'm just trying to catch my breath from that, Mr. Freeze. Frankly, let's change the subject." It's like, why didn't you go after him?
Yeah, and again, it shows the power that money has in this country.
I don't know that I would say that it, because she's married to Alan Greenspan. I don't think she's afraid of money. I think she was in shock.
You don't think she was afraid of going, the station going, or the studio going, sorry, you're fired?
No. No, I don't think she was. I think that she was literally in shock that somebody would say that.
But I hear people say that all the time, especially people of his class. I've got an uncle who, he just thinks that's rope is his thing. It's not aspirin. It's rope.
What?
Rope. You could tie their knees together. Yeah. As if the man has nothing to do with it. I had nothing to do with it.
Oh, my God.
I mean, but, you know, they've been, again, my position on this stuff is this is stuff they've been whispering to each other in their little think tanks and in their little secret clubs and their secret societies and their clubs for years. It's just now they feel truly emboldened to just say it, to just let it out. And he did.
He said it. No, he just said it.
Yeah, well. There you go. But I got to be honest with you. I was kind of amused today to see the big House panel on what to do with women and contraception attended by all men.
Yeah, it was attended by all men. Now, apparently, there was going to be a second panel of witnesses that I think was going to have a token woman or two. But, you see, nobody takes any notice of the second panel because the second panel is not important.
Right.
And the press only covers the first panel and people only listen to who's on the first panel. And it was religious leaders and professors. And there were no women at all. And the woman that the Democrats wanted to have on was not allowed on by Daryl Issa because he said that she was not qualified.
Today, ironically, and this is one of those ironic history moments, you know, I went looking around for stuff, and evidently today, 95 years ago today, Emma Goldman was arrested in New York for talking about birth control issues.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, it's mind-blowing. In fact, one of her best quotes is, they want us to keep our mouths shut and our wombs open.
Wow.
And you look at these panels, and how can you, 95 years later, not make the exact same argument? And again, I go back to why in God's name would a woman vote for any of them?
I can't answer that question.
All right, so let's move on then. It seems like it's one of those topics. I mean, you're from across the pond over there. Are they as insane and as repressed?
No, they're not. They're not as insane. They're not as repressed. Yes, there are people who are anti-birth control, but they are a distinct minority and they are laughed out of the park.
Why can't we do that here? Why can't we laugh at people like Santorum? Because to me, he's just plain nuts. All right.
Well. Because we take them seriously because there's a religious component and we're afraid of laughing at religion.
All right. Well, since we're talking about the nether regions, the underwear bomber, what happened to him today?
Yes, the underwear bomber got life today. He got life in prison. He is going down. He was sentenced by U.S. District Court Judge Nancy Edmonds in Detroit, and he did plead guilty last year to conspiracy to commit an act of terrorism transcending national borders, attempted murder within the special aircraft jurisdiction of the United States, and several other things. And he is going down, and he was quite gleeful, apparently. He defended his actions as rooted in the Quran, saying Mujahideen are proud to kill in the name of God, and that's exactly what God told us to do in the Quran. Today is a day of victory. The majority of Muslim scholars would disagree with that.
Yeah, I understand that. But, there's part of me and there's, the angry part of me that goes, you know, probably we should have given him his wish. I'm not a death penalty person, but I know there are some that are. And then the other part of me says, no, if you'd have done that, you would have just made a martyr out of him.
Exactly. Let him sit in his underwear for the rest of his life.
No, make him sit without underwear.
Ooh.
What else is going on? Maybe a vote on the payroll tax deal Friday? Is that going to happen?
It's looking likely. It may get delayed until Saturday, and that would be really a procedural issue because the House Republicans set up this three-day rule whereby things have to be out in the open for 3 days. And it's a question of did they get the deal done in time. So it may be Saturday, but it's probably going to be tomorrow. John Boehner said today the deal struck was a fair agreement, but he's calling it not a job growth bill, but an economic relief package that was necessitated by the failure of President Obama's policies.
So let me ask you this. Maybe they get this done, and I'm hoping they do. It's kind of pathetic that we're going to go beating up on federal workers again. They're the constant whipping boy. We haven't seemed to get over wanting to beat up on them. Is anything else going to get done this legislative year? I saw Lindsey Graham, who said that he doesn't think anything else of any real substance is going to get done. Maybe they'll name some more post offices or roads and bridges, but nothing of real substance.
Well, they did some post offices earlier this week, actually, I think. Well, they were going to do the transportation bill, but John Boehner had to delay that this week because he couldn't get the votes, and it looked like it was going down, so I'm not sure even that's going to get done. Boehner says, for those of you who haven't noticed, the president checked out last Labor Day and has been unengaged in leading our country ever since, so he thinks nothing's going to get done. No, I don't think very much is going to get done, but what they need to get done and what they may start to focus on is, you may remember when the super committee failed, we automatically get these triggers. So come January 2013, we're going to get $1.2 trillion in automatic cuts.
Right.
That can be avoided if they come up with a package of some kind this year.
And McCain has a deal.
Well, he has a deal, but there are all kinds of other people who can work on deals. There's a lot of them there, and if they put their minds to it and worked on deals and spent the next few months working on a deal, they could come up with something, cuts, increases, all kinds of things. They could come up with a deal, and they could avoid the sequestration that is due to kick in less than a year now.
Yeah, and we could maybe cut more from federal workers. Maybe we cut more from social programs, maybe cut education a little more, maybe not have a transportation bill. Yeah, that's a good idea. Yeah, let's do that.
They've got to do something. Otherwise, we've got, you know, $500 billion coming from domestic programs and $500 billion coming from defense.
Yeah, and going back to the transportation bill, I just don't understand why we can't get a transportation bill pushed through. Look, I mean, even the Republicans get it. La Tourette, one of the Republicans from Ohio, he gets it. For every $1 billion we invest in infrastructure, it's going to create 42,000 jobs. We need jobs. Why can't we get a simple transportation bill passed?
It was a very bad bill.
Then go back and rewrite it.
Well, that's something else, isn't it?
So I guess we got to wait until the next election. Like our governor here, he said transportation's a big issue. It took us a couple of decades to get here, so maybe next year, maybe next decade. All right, and finally,
we may have to wait. We may have to wait that long.
Yeah. Well, and you know what? Maybe it'll be here in Pennsylvania. It's the year of the Bible.
You told me that.
Yeah,
I think it's
important. And I've been saying it a whole bunch because I think it's important. We're cutting, programs for old people. We're cutting programs for poor people. We're cutting programs for the disabled. But it's the year of the Bible. Remember that. But I'm thinking part of me says it's about bringing prayer back. Since we're not going to have a transportation bill, a lot of praying in Pennsylvania going over the bridges. Oh, please don't collapse. So
that'll do it.
And finally, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. We've got some targets.
Yes, it's going after some controversial industries. This is the nation's largest debt collectors, the primary credit reporting agencies like Experian, Equifax, and TransUnion, and other lesser-known consumer reporting agencies. This would be the first time that these businesses that are non-traditional financial institutions will be subject to the same examination process as banks.
Oh, that's good. Can we lock people up?
I don't know whether they will do that, but there will be federal regulations. And right now, federal regulations don't require, for example, the fourth bureau firms. These are the ones that target 30 million consumers outside mainstream financial systems. Don't require them to disclose when they share your financial history or with whom. There's no way to opt out when they do. And no one's even tracking the accuracy of their financial reports.
Wow. You know, I look at this whole mortgage thing, and I look at this whole financial thing, and it's just insane to me. The story yesterday, I think it was yesterday in Reuters, they had when Citigroup settled a claim under the False Claims Act. $158 million they settled this claim. In the article, it says that it cost the U.S. government $200 million. I guess only in this country do we say, especially to corporations, yeah, you cost us $200 million, but we're only going to fine you $158. And that's punishment, I guess, in this world. I'm hoping this new bureau, I'm hoping they do something.
They're trying. The question is, will they be sued? And because of Richard Cordray's appointment, which was a recess appointment, some say wrongly, and will that slow them down or stop them completely?
Well, that is the plan. Victoria Jones, I appreciate the time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Let's take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Radio of, for, and by We the Working People. The Rick Smith Show.
On June 25, 1938, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt signed the Fair Labor Standards Act into law. Viewed as one of the final pieces of legislation of FDR's New Deal and the single most worker-friendly piece of legislation ever written, the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938 was a victory not only for labor unions, but for workers, families, and children across the country. FDR called the new law the most far-reaching, far-sighted program for the benefit of workers ever adopted in this or any other country. This visionary piece of legislation put a ceiling over hours and a floor under wages, mandating a 44-hour work week, a 25-cent minimum wage, and time and a half for overtime. The Fair Labor Standards Act was later amended to 40 hours per week and 40 cents per hour. The law also excluded children from working dangerous jobs and set standard conditions for the employment of child workers to avoid continued exploitation of children. The Fair Labor Standards Act has been changed or amended at least 43 different times. These alterations have been used both to expand worker protections, such as raising the minimum wage, prohibiting age discrimination, and requiring equal pay, and to restrict and take away protections such as the Taft-Hartley Act and the 2004 Fair Pay Amendment. Today, we take the 40-hour work week, minimum wages, overtime, and child labor protections for granted. But up until the passage of the Fair Labor Standards Act, workers were at the mercy of their employers, and children were dying in industrial accidents. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Well, I know that somewhere down inside they're just feeling small and scared.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, something I said tick you off, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. I do enjoy the insanity that comes with some emails. Also, if you missed any portion of the program, you can download the podcast from the website, or if you have a smartphone, get the Stitcher app. We've got a button right on our website to help you get that, so you can take the program on the go. So yesterday, the president was in Wisconsin, giving a speech at Master Lock, and we talked a little bit about that. You're talking about insourcing. Evidently, you know, the conditions are bad enough here. Wages are low enough, and workers are compliant enough that we can start bringing those jobs, you know, back from China and Vietnam and from Canada. I found it very interesting the president mentioned Caterpillar in his speech. Caterpillar bringing jobs back from Canada because they wanted those Canadian workers to take a 55% pay cut. And as I said before, remember, how bad has it gotten that the Canadian companies are threatening their workers with moving to the United States? Much like the companies have been doing to U.S. workers here about threatening to go to Mexico or China, they're threatening to come here. Think about that for a second. But anyway, while he was in Milwaukee, he was there at the Master Lock plant. He said, you know, out on this article by this Donovan Slack over at Politico, and I guess Donovan is a woman's name in this case. She wrote, it's very clear what side President Obama is on here in Wisconsin. Behind the stage where he will speak today are two flags, the American one, as usual, and right alongside it, a flag for the local union, Wisconsin, 1848. It's the Wisconsin state flag. I mean, there's really no punchline other than it's the Wisconsin state flag. There's the U.S. flag and the state flag right there. This person, so twisted in the mind, thinking that, and I guess buying the right-wing media frenzy that, you know, it's all about the unions, and the unions, they're controlling things. No, it's the state flag. You know, every state has a flag. This was theirs. And there's, you know, what's interesting about it is, you know, there's some things in there that are pretty working class. That I guess maybe they just thought, well, you know, that's the union symbol. You know, a badger and, you know, some a worker and some other things, you know, the hammer and stuff, you know. That must be the union, right? And I go back and I think about the history of Wisconsin, the progressive state where most of the very good stuff came out of. Workman's compensation, for instance, came out of. Now, granted, we screwed that up, and I would love to see you just get rid of workers' compensation, tie it into a national health care program, and have another way of going about it, because this whole idea of having states pitted against each other, who's going to offer the worst benefits, not working for working people. But I find it interesting that the media, and Politico is part of the media, I guess. You know, we know which side. We know who Obama's in. We know who he's in bed with. I'm surprised that it didn't go this way. There was a union flag, and surprisingly, they let an American flag up. Because these people, they hate Americas. They hate America. You know, Alan West said that today. You know, they hate Americans. And Santorum, they look down at their nose. The snob, the elite, they look down upon us. Yeah, they look down on you because you're nuts. But you look at this whole media structure and this echo chamber, who has now, like I said earlier, the tweet of the day, Tom Marino, the representative from up north here in Pennsylvania. In our WXPI listening area. Third anniversary of the stimulus not working. Yet, here we are. Weekly unemployment claims at a four-year low. Profits at GM are going up. We're seeing, you know, Wall Street is fat and happy. They're back. They've been back for some time. But you got the right-wing echo chamber out there. You've got all these people. Oh, it was a failure. Oh, it was horrible. Oh, it was bad. All of these paid puppets, paid for by the Koch brothers and the Olin Foundation and the Bradley Foundation and the Scaifes and the Coors and all of the Waltons and all of them who fund these right-wing think tanks, who fund these professors. And what's amazing to me is how little we give them. It's a couple thousand dollars. Here's a pittance. Say what we want. You know, I go back to the article that I read earlier on Foxconn, the big electronics factory in China. And the minister of education there said that their job is to fill workers. Their job is to make sure that they have enough workers to feed their industries. And, you know, the more I listen, and it's one of those things that you listen to the rhetoric of the politicians in this country, and you watch the destruction of public education, especially here in our state of Pennsylvania and across the country as we move to charter schools, for-profit charter schools, so that they get paid first and you end up destroying the public school. This push to, we need to give people the skills to get jobs. And I guess I have a very different idea of what education should be. My vision of education is teaching people, one, how to learn and then how to think. Having the ability to learn new skills throughout your life, not just focusing on, and this is what scares me. I'm worried that starting in kindergarten, we're going to start focusing on curriculum saying, well, you live near natural gas, you're all going to be working in the frack fields. This is what they're doing in China. And they're taking these kids and we're making them interns, which is a lovely title for, oh, you're not going to get paid and you're going to do all the garbage work and work long hours and be disposable. That's what intern means, especially there. And, you know, I remember that article that was in the New York Times not too long ago talking about Apple bringing jobs back. Never going to happen because over there they can raise up, you know, 8,000 people to get to the factory line to do just-in-time production. And you go, well, how many of those are interns and how many of those people are living right there? And this article that I read earlier today, they're saying 300,000 people within a two-kilometer area, within the workplace, within the little shop in these dormitories, 10 people to a dorm room. That's the conditions that corporate America wants. That's the vision that they have for this country. Look at what's going on there. Look at what's drawing them there. That's what they're telling us they want. This whole guise of, oh, we need to lower our tax rate so we're more competitive, is a bunch of horse pucky. What they want is they want you on a string. They want you controllable. They want your thoughts controllable, they want your actions controllable, and they want you dealt with if you dare have the audacity to stand up and fight back or to say anything out of line. Global free trade is a failure. The way it's set up right now is an absolute abysmal failure. It is destroying working families across the globe. It's enriching the wealth class. It's doing that pretty well. See, the problem is we haven't gotten down far enough yet to see the effects of it. And while in China there are some pressures to raise wages a little bit, and understand what they're going to do is, oh, we're going to start pulling those jobs back so we can put those people in back under their thumb. I'm not encouraged by the messaging I'm seeing. And I see this echo chamber out there. These right-wingers, you know, going around saying, well, you know, Obama's a failure. And there are people who might buy it. The economy isn't really recovering. And people might buy it because there are still a lot of people struggling. There's still a lot of folks struggling to make ends meet, struggling to make it to the next day. And for pennies, you get people like Sarah Palin or, you know, look at the presidential candidates. I mean, Santorum, pretty cheap. Couple hundred thousand dollars would foster freeze paid for that. And look at the guy we talked about yesterday with his lean Six Sigma. You got Gingrich going around hawking some guy's book on the presidential trail. It's nuts. And yesterday we found out about the Heartland Institute. And it wasn't anything shocking. It wasn't anything that we didn't know. It just confirmed what we had always known, that they're bought and paid for by the billionaire class. They're bought and paid for. It is as it is. And I see Microsoft is, well, we weren't a big contributor. We just gave them free software. Well, that's still a contribution, in my opinion, because they would have had to have bought it if you didn't give it to them. Anyway, today, if you missed any portion of the program, thericksmithshow.com, the best place to go to get that. If you've got a smartphone, the Stitcher app. And again, you can always email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I do enjoy reading insane emails and some good ones as well. So, again, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Have a great night. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@thericksmithshow.com or interact with us anytime at thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath. Let us sway.